Welcome to the TMRN Time Monk Radio Network. I'm Jules, and today is the 2nd of April 2011. We have author and researcher Mr. John Lash. John's website is www.metahistory.org. Hi, John, and welcome to the WebBot Forum Roundtable.
Hi there. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. The WebBot administrator is Fox, and today he'll be doing the recording and technical support of the show. Several members of the forum were kind enough to join us tonight. They include moderators Lolly, members Patrick, Dead Poet, Uranus Rising, and Odison. For listeners, this interview will assume you have a fairly good understanding of John's work on alternative history, including the Nag Hammadi texts, as well as a vast array of John's interviews on YouTube. This video will be available on YouTube for free on the WebBot Forum channel and linked from webbotforum.com. John, are you all ready to go, sir?
I sure am.
Fantastic. John, as a first question, we wanted to know what your opinion was on the WebBot project. All humans are psychic, and those psychic impressions are leaked out in our everyday lives many ways, from actions we take, instinct, through our body gestures, and through the words we use in conversation verbally and written, which is what Cliff uses. What do you think of this premise, and more importantly, if you have read the reports and Cliff's articles, what do you think of his forecasts and the theory of an expanding Earth and Sun?
Oh, well, that's quite a question. I'll start by responding to the last phrase. I think the expanding Earth and Sun theory is sensational and just about the best thing to come along in a while. I think it will be extremely helpful, for instance, in understanding the physics of of the Earth and some of the Earth changes that we're facing right now. I think it's a tremendous breakthrough. As for Cliff's work in general, I must say I haven't really followed it that closely. I'm more aware of his reputation than I am of the particular contents or even the method of what he does. I did hear a long interview with him on Red Ice or something. Very impressive, a very cogent mind, and I found some of his perspectives and his way of treating things to be fascinating. I just don't know about using the internet as a kind of oracular or divinatory device. I don't know one way or the other. I wouldn't rule it out. Of course, we do have this sea of chatter that we float in of the collective unconscious, and it's possible, given that many people are putting that chatter into this medium, that you could go in and extract from this medium a portrait of what is going on in the unconscious or the subconscious. My own history with divination has been a long one, but the type of divination that I practice has been totally natural, involving gazing at the stars and the traditional forms of watching omens in the sky, omens in nature, plants and animals and so forth. So I can't really say much more than that. I also, I did astrology, a form of astrology, for about 35 years. And I was a professional in that genre. And one of the first things that I used to say to clients, I had a couple of disclaimers. And one disclaimer was that I didn't predict. So I'm not very much into prediction. And I wonder, given the pace of events these days, if prediction might be going out of style as events are catching up very fast with what is being predicted. There's a tremendous momentum shift in time happening right now. In any case, I can see the value and the challenge to see what's coming. I guess you could say that I find another challenge in to be what's coming.
Okay, thank you, John. Just a quick follow-up on that. You mentioned the pace of change occurring. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Terence McKenna and his concept of the eschaton and the end of time. So do you think that's probably what's happening, a quickening?
Right. I think there's a quickening in the consciousness, in the awareness of the Earth. I know there is. I use the analogy of a lucid dream to describe the condition of the planetary consciousness, the planetary awareness of Gaia, or Gaia Sophia. So if you consider that Gaia Sophia, the planet we inhabit, is an entity, a being, consider that not that she's waking from a dream, but that she's waking up in a dream. She's having a lucid dream. And those of you who've had lucid dreams, many people have had them, will notice something happens when you wake up in a lucid dream. There's a state of intense excitement and agitation, and things speed up very quickly in the dream as soon as you realize that you are awake but still dreaming. So I would consider that this accounts to a large extent for the phenomenal change that can be felt now in the rhythm and pacing of events and in the flow of time itself.
Thank you, John. We have two other opening questions before we jump into it. The first is from sure. Dead Poet.
Well, I pretty much follow the Tibetan view, which has been expressed also in Asian metaphysics, in the Vedanta or Tantrika teachings, that awakening, as we call it, is a perpetual process. It's happening all the time. It's the nature of consciousness itself to become enlightened, as it were. In Dzogchen and Tibetan Buddhism, they call this the self-liberating nature of mind. They also call it the spontaneously arising Dakini wisdom. So normally we just go through life and we're aware of things that are around us, but we're not necessarily aware of what makes us aware. And well, what makes us aware is the ground consciousness, which is of the nature of bliss, enlightenment, and pure play, pure discovery, as it were. So I consider now that awakening is perpetual, and I live for some years now in a kind of state of perpetual awakening. But in terms of my personal biography, of course, there were key moments that put me on the path I'm on. The first one would have been around the age of 4 when I had a lucid dream of witch, and that witch turned out to be my spiritual guardian. And I think many people have these experiences. I think that from a very early point in life, almost perhaps pre-verbally, some signals may come. Then when we become verbal creatures, we get all kinds of signs, and there are supernatural forces in the background of our lives. I don't think I'm unusual in having had such an encounter. Perhaps what makes me different, if at all, is that I stuck with it. That's the difficult thing, you say. You can have spiritual awakenings all through your life. You can have encounters with the supernatural. You can have glimmers of the greater scheme of things, but you have to stick with it. You have to be rigorous, because there are so many things that happen in the world that will drive it out of you, and so many things coming from other people that will contradict and defy or dismiss that which arises innately. But that which arises innately is the very source of consciousness, and if we can stay with that, we can stay with the whole process of consciousness.
Thank you, John. Lolly has a forum member question. Lolly?
Hi, John. This question is from forum member Bluebird. He would like to know, Freud's ideas are being eclipsed by Jung, Campbell, and people like yourself today. Where is the tipping point here? Please map it out for us.
Well, the tipping point is when we get beyond ideas and theories and we go into the living dynamics of imagination. I won't get into Freud because I don't feel like Freud bashing this evening, but I would just mention that he's someone that is a perfect example of how the worst possible ideas could become current and popular. I mean, you really have to scratch your head about that one. Jung was somewhat better, but not entirely. and he had a lot of problems. Both Freud and Jung, by the way, more or less vampirized women in their own ways. Jung was a bit more gentlemanly and loving about it. But Freud made his career off hysterical women, and he lied about their experiences. Jung had tremendous input and guidance from women, and he didn't give them much credit for it. So there's a man-woman problem in the background of some of the great, so-called great ideas that have been running this planet. And I would suggest that's why perhaps some of those great ideas aren't so great as they're put up to be. Two things to me are essential for us to get on track in the future. One, to move from mere ideas and theories into a verifiable dynamic of imagination. And two, for more of the directing ideas that we do come up with to be conjointly developed by men and women together and not simply to come from the great minds of certain men. Finally, I just mentioned Campbell because I'm in his lineage as in a way, as you know. Now, I said before that if you read Creative Mythology by Joseph Campbell, you'll find in there that he puts out the four principles. Can't remember what they are right now. In the first 20 pages, the four principles of so-called creative mythology, which he understood to be the next step after him. But he didn't actually practice those principles. So for me, Campbell's work is like a diving board, and it brings you right to the end. If you can imagine yourself standing on the end of the diving board, bouncing up and down, that's where Campbell's work will take you regarding the power of imagination. My work is the plunge into the pool.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lolly. Thank you, John. We've broken up our questions into topics, and this next topic is on Sophia. Lolly, please ask your question.
In the spirit of oral tradition, John, can you tell us the sacred vision theory of the earth, the Sophia myth?
I'd love to. Let's
Great.
Get together on a mountaintop, let's build a fire, and give me about 3 days. And while I'm reciting it and dancing, we can all dance and eat and party. It would take about, if we followed the real traditional oral practices of storytelling, such as you find, say, among the Navajo and the Hopi, the American Indians, it would take 4 or 5 hours to tell this story properly. There is a narration of the story on the site Rock the Talk, and there are, of course, written versions of it on Metahistory. What I would like to do in the context of this discussion, if you don't mind, is I would like to tell you what the story is rather than to tell you episodically the entire story, which would take me at least 40 minutes. So if you don't mind, I'd like to do that.
Yes, please.
That would be great.
Sure. There are many, many creation myths from all cultures of the world. I'm sure you know that. Anybody who's looked into mythology runs into them. This is the most unique creation myth in the entire world. There is nothing else that compares to it. And that is because the Gnostic myth of the divine Sophia, which comes from the pagan mysteries, is actually the biography of the planet Earth. It is a creation myth that not only describes how the Earth came into existence, how the entire solar system came into existence, but it also describes who was the informing, indwelling being of the Earth before she became Earth. Now, there are many names for the goddess in many cultures, indigenous cultures, classic cultures, Greek, Roman, and so forth. But Sophia is a unique name because it is the name that identifies the Earth in the only myth that tells you who the Earth was before she became the Earth, you see? And the Sophia myth is a galactic myth. This is also unique. It tells a story of something that happened in our galaxy, not in the universe at large, not in the mystic metaphysical reaches of space and time, but right here in the home galaxy. And it explains that a divine being, a goddess called Sophia, inhabiting the center of the galaxy, was instrumental in engineering the human genome. So it also explains the origin of the human species. We did not come from another planetary system. We were not created by extraterrestrial super race, at least according to the Gnostics. They denied that rumor. We were actually engineered, the human genome was actually engineered in the center of the galaxy that we now inhabit. And so Faya was one of the engineers of this great project, which I call the divine experiment. So you have a tremendous amount of information in this myth about the origin of the Earth, the origin of the human race, the origin of the archontic or alien mind parasites that were inadvertently produced in the early phase of the solar system, the way the solar system arose before the Earth did, and the Earth was formed from an entirely different set of laws than the rest of the solar system, and became captured in the inorganic clockworks of the solar system. The way that the Archons operate and inhabit the planetary system, the way that humanity came to emerge on Earth, and basically the amazing fact that the Earth itself, the planet Earth, is actually a metamorphosis of this divine goddess that was in the galactic center. So we are actually the Earth, and none of the other planets in the solar system are such. Only the Earth is a direct outgrowth, as it were, of divine stellar plasmic energies from the galactic center. So this is a remarkable myth. It fits in a lot of ways with Gaia theory. It fits in with plasma theory, plasma cosmology. And finally, the really wonderful thing I feel about the Sophia myth is that it's interactive and it's open-ended. There is no end to this myth. The final chapter has not been written. And the Gnostics made it very clear that the story of the divine Sophia is not a story that has an apocalyptic ending. It doesn't have a pre-written conclusion. The conclusion of this myth is the collaboration between the Anthropos, humanity, and Sophia, the goddess. It depends upon a collaboration, a recognition, and a power sharing between us and her. And so the myth is interactive. We're now in the interactive phase of the myth. And the way that the myth ends, the way that it resolves itself, depends to a certain degree on us and on Sophia. So all of that is truly, truly remarkable if you think about it. And it also gives you some idea of how this myth from the pagan mysteries cannot be compared to any other myth that we have inherited from the past.
Okay, so if it's incomplete, then the Sophia myth, how can it inform our actions now at this time in world history? Does it offer any practical solutions for now?
If you're talking about practical solutions to social, particular social problems, I would say, yes, it can. For instance, I would say it can offer a practical solution to the free energy problem. Because why don't we have free energy? You know, if we had free energy on this planet, and it was, and by the way, free energy has to be free. So I'm not talking about free energy devices that only millionaires could afford, okay? If we had a free energy accessible to the public at large, we could build a utopia, social utopia on Earth, because it would eliminate competition and control through the control of resources. And how could this myth resolve the problem of free energy? Well, do you want to know how free energy works? One way to find out is to learn from the goddess herself. The goddess is a teacher. The Theleste, or the seers of the mystery schools, learned directly from Sophia through the medium of the organic light. And they learned many, many things about nature. and the supernatural worlds and the cosmos at large. And then they turned around because they were the teachers and educators of the human race and taught those things to the ancient world. That's why the ancient world in Europe, in pre-Christian Europe, was highly literate and highly civilized, because all kinds of scientific, artistic, mathematical, musical, astronomical knowledge was acquired by this group of people who could be interactive with the planetary mind, the planetary goddess. So there are many solutions that could be given to our world, the solution of how to deal with predators, how to deal with that part of the human species that preys on the other part, or the only species that I know of where some members prey on the other members. The answer to how to deal with a predatory species could be found by direct interaction with Gaia. And by that, I mean by communicating with her. And just as I'm communicating with you, I'm not talking about some sentimental idea of going back to nature. So all of this would fall into the category of what the Gnostics called Gaia's corruption. You see, in the myth, they said that when she became so infatuated with the experiment that could unfold with the human race, that she fell into the experiment. She got involved in it. This is the meaning of the fall of the wisdom goddess. So she's deeply involved in our experiment here on Earth. Our experiment is going badly wrong. Why? Because we're not in touch with her who was the originator of the experiment. So the whole course of humanity could be corrected through this Gaian Sophianic connection. And once the connection is made, that's the first step, obviously, then particular social problems or particular scientific problems could be undertaken in the context of that profound interactivity with her.
Thanks, John.
Welcome.
John, just a follow-up. It's obviously quite interesting that we're approaching 2012 and an alignment with the center of the galaxy, and that's where Sophia was born. So it's quite interesting in the 20,000-year cycle. But my question was, obviously, meditators, a lot of the Eastern meditators, get into a state of samadhi, and I'm just wondering if that is the state where we can actually communicate with Sophia.
Yes, it is, but in their way of getting into it, they don't reach her. So, at least I don't see any evidence that they do. So, the Asian tradition of mysticism has as its highest goal the state of samadhi. For instance, a classical example would be Yogananda's experience of samadhi, described in his book, The Autobiography of a Yogi. I don't know if you've ever heard of that book, but it's a classic.
Yeah, I've read it. Yep.
Yeah, it came out in 1945. Everyone really should read that book to get a picture of what it was really like to be a yogi who experienced superconsciousness. And he describes it vividly in detail, his experience of samadhi, and how he could see the structure of the galaxy, how he had a cosmic vision, how he saw everything. As you know, some shamans do as well. They can see on the galactic scale. They can see on the molecular scale. We as a species are gifted with these occult powers and the potential for samadhi, but the samadhi of Gaia is a very particular kind of attention. It's not simply the attainment of the state of cosmic consciousness, but it's a relational experience in that state. So you're not just going to the core of the galaxy or going into some kind of cosmic bliss. You're actually encountering and meeting the living divinity of the earth. And that is in the state of samadhi, but it's what you would call a samadhi sambija, with content.
Thank you, John. Uranus, you have a question for John.
Hi, John.
Hi there.
Hi. I've got three form questions from Green Meadow. And the first one is, I have seen earthquakes as a birth contraction wave and as a kundalini wave. How do you see them? If it is a birth process, what are we birthing?
Right. I've seen them that way too. In fact, right here in Andalusia, where I often go to sacred places in the hills, I usually do my shamanic rites in places where I can look at the Sierra de Libar, which is a mountain range to the west of Ronda, a very beautiful mountain range. And I've seen that mountain range rippling like a great serpent. I take this to be the perception of the planetary Kundalini, but I wouldn't necessarily equate it with a birthing process. I'm very careful about this, with this metaphor of birthing. A little careful, especially when it comes to Gaia and the planet. You have to understand her. And I understand that that there is planetary Kundalini activating very powerfully right now. It is connected with the change in the polarization of the magnetic field of the Earth, about the breakdown and the turbulence in the magnetic field, and many other changes. The Kundalini of Gaia is really coming on strong. But bear in mind something that the tantrics always emphasize, that the nature of Kundalini is bliss, and it has nothing to do with biological reproduction. So the same holds for Gaia, for the planet herself. The nature of her Kundalini is a force of bliss, and it has nothing to do with her giving birth to anything. I don't think that she's giving birth. I wouldn't use that metaphor. My metaphor for Gaia right now, especially this since the last month, with this tremendous earthquake in Japan and the other seismic activity, my metaphor for Gaia would be this. She is like a big, big ship, like a big ocean liner. Let's call her the mother ship. And she has been on a journey for a long time, but due to the peculiarities at the beginning of her journey, she lost her navigational orientation to the place she came from. The Gnostic myth says this. When Sophia fell out of the galactic center, she found herself removed from the aeons, the divinities of the galactic center. She lost communication. And part of the myth we're living now is how she corrects her course and goes back into communication with the center of the galaxy. So the mothership is in stormy seas right now. But she's making a massive, massive course correction since March 19th. She's signaling, the mothership is signaling the navigational coordinates, as it were, from Earth back to the Pleromic Center. And as she turns, she's cracking and heaving. You know, I was on a freighter once for 3 days in a typhoon in the South China Sea. And I can tell you, there were 60-foot swells. And when a boat is in that kind of water and it moves and through those massive swells, it cracks. And, you know, a boat consists of plates, just like the Earth, plates that are welded together. The plates crack and warp and groan. And this is not a birth process. This is the process of the great mothership Earth correcting her course and bringing herself around to port and around toward galactic center. That would be my metaphor.
Thank you, John.
And you're welcome.
The second question from Green Meadow is, what is planetary tantra?
Planetary tantra is the way to connect and bond with Gaia through the bioelectromagnetic field that is her Kundalini and her energetic force. And it is the way to bond consciously and deliberately, to bond your body, which is a bioelectromagnetic antenna, to hers through the iron in your blood. The iron in your blood that's streaming in your blood, in your hemoglobin right now, constitutes a kind of antenna, a fluid antenna. As you stand there or sit there, the blood in your veins forms an antenna, and that antenna is picking up signals and can transmit as well to the bioelectromagnetic environment, which is the body of the surface of Gaia's world, her skin, as it were. She's got us under her skin. She's got the human species under her skin. And planetary tantra is the way to make that connection conscious and deliberate and intentional. It's the way to communicate telepathically with her. It's a two-way communication back and forth, but largely consists of taking instruction directly from the planetary goddess, taking instruction, which the Gnostics called the divine mathesis. And that was the point, that was the secret of what they did in these mysteries. You know, the secret that has never been told before. It wasn't never been told verbally or publicly. Planetary tantra also has a lot to do with desire and pleasure. It is a way to realize the most powerful expression of your own self and your true desires and your capacity for pleasure and bliss and rapture through this Sophianic connection. It is a way to be guided by the Sophianic vision story and at the same time to be a participant and collaborator in that story. It is the portal to our involvement in Gaia's correction and in her return to communication with the galactic center.
Thank you, John. And the final question from Green Meadow is, the pagans had a very different view of sex. How do you define healthy sexuality? And how can sex be used in healing?
Well, I finally get to talk about sex, since it's taken me years now before somebody asked me a question about sex. I'm thrilled. Okay. Listen, healthy sexuality is, first of all, honest sexuality. And that means that there is a moment in life when you can make a commitment to your sexuality by understanding that it is an instrument of Gaia herself. It is an instrument of her own desire. And that's why I call Sophia Sophia, because it rhymes with desire. And desire is a very important force for Sophia. It's even in a way more important than love. I don't talk that much about love in planetary tantra, although the factor is there. But the really driving force is desire. And one way that I describe planetary tantra is that it's a power-sharing arrangement between a human being and a superhuman being. But sexually, it's a arrangement of three entities. The most healthy, powerful, honest, open, dynamic, and healing form of sex would be the sex between two people who triangulate with a third point, which is the planet itself. That is today, that is to say, the understanding that the sexual energy, and not for biological procreation, by the way, this is completely non-procreative. The sexual energy and the bliss and the excitement and the heightening of your senses that comes from sexual contact belongs in her dynamic. And so doing it in a connection with the earth is doing it at a much, much higher octave of sexuality. And of course it is healing because, you know, sex is like, you can go into samadhi in sex, you can go into trance. On metahistory.org I pointed out that the state of deep immersion, cellular immersion, that you reach with the use of shamanic plants is very similar to the deep body immersion you can reach through really good, intense sexual experiences. So sexuality and shamanism need to be brought together and reconciled to something that hasn't really been done so far as I can tell. But there are tremendous possibilities. And I call the sexual dimension of planetary tantra, I call that Kala Tantra, because it's particularly connected with the goddess Kali.
Thank you, John. That's great.
John, just a quick question on that. first of all, I think you can also go into different states of samadhi, I guess, going to the restroom or the toilet. But in regards to this question, I've lost my mind, actually. I've forgotten about it. Basically with... actually, I've totally lost it. Sorry about that. We'll go on to the next section.
Sure.
We'll go on to the sections on the archons. Patrick.
Sure. I'd just love to make a comment, though, on what you just said, if I might.
Go ahead.
About samadhi on the way to the toilet or washing the dishes.
Yes.
In a sense, that's true. You know, I think that it's important for people to understand, people who are interested in mystical experience, that cosmic consciousness can happen to someone spontaneously. You don't have to practice yoga for years. You don't even need to practice anything. It is there waiting to happen. It's a mystical experience waiting to happen. So you can go into samadhi, but the real kick is what you bring out of samadhi. That's the trick. So many people do spontaneously go into mystical experiences, and they have what Stan Grof calls spiritual emergencies, and they may momentarily reach states of heightened awareness and so forth, but that's not enough. It's what you bring out of it that matters, what you bring out from it, what you bring back to the world where you live, where you interact with other people, and how you apply that higher consciousness to the life around you. That's the key.
Thanks, John. Actually, I just remembered my question. In regards to planetary tantra, so I guess if you want to be in union with, with your partner and the Earth, I guess doing it at certain times such as the solstice or the equinox, and I guess through rituals, which we know that the powers that be actually do rituals, is probably some way of getting closer and increasing the experience?
Well, we're getting into some really hot-button subjects here, aren't we? First of all, I want to say I have big doubts about that. I think the powers that be are getting very much overhyped and have been built them. So they must pay for the PR that builds them up into some kind of masterminds who are mind-controlling the human species. I don't really buy that proposition. But we might get into that later when we're talking about the archons. There is no ritual. You know, pagans used to do sexual activities at the summer solstice and at certain times of the year, like the 1st of May, because they felt that correctly so, that the sexual or erotic forces of the earth were higher at that time. But the practices of planetary tantra and Kala tantra do not go in that direction at all. They're entirely different, and they are not ritualistic. They do not use Kama Sutra-type sexual poses. Timing would be a factor, but they're entirely different than anything that has been practiced so far.
Thank you, John. Okay, we'll move on to the Archon section. Patrick, you have a question for John.
Yes, good evening, John.
Hi there.
There's no real clean way to segue from sex or tantric sex to Archons, but we'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you don't like to dwell on Archons, but we have a couple questions, and this one struck me while I was watching your CD, Sophia Returning.
Sure.
You discuss how the intent of the Archons is to have humanity live through false or replicant means, most notably through those provided by advances of technology. And the Gnostics warned that we might deviate from our optimal course of evolution when we get lost in mental fabrications. And aside from pornography and other issues we can discuss as a follow-up, I'd like to pose a question regarding our function on the Webbot forum.
Sure.
You touched on your knowledge of the Webbots, but in the context of archonic control, what are your thoughts about following predictive linguistics, which is forecasting future events by analyzing changes on internet language, or any other means of technology that could be popularized and used to guide human behavior? And doesn't it make sense for humans to use the internet as a place to sniff out current and future states of affairs? In your opinion, where and how does one draw the line?
Well, that's a damn good question, my friend. And I have to tell you that I can't answer it. authoritatively because I'm not as deep into the medium as you. I suffer from a certain handicap is that I'm not as deeply involved with the internet and how it works. I just use it to make phone calls and do interviews. And as far as I'm concerned, if it just served as an information exchange system and a way to talk to people around the world and a global radio device, I'd be very happy. I confess my inadequacies here, but I do get the question, and it is very relevant to our understanding of the archonic factor in our own minds. Okay? So I'm going to give you my best shot at answering the question. Why shouldn't we use the internet to delve into the technology of the internet and IT, informational technology, to delve into the workings of our minds? Because we don't need it. And there's a much better way and a more direct way to do it. A cleaner way, a much more exciting way, and a way that allows us to be directly interactive with the source of our minds. You see, right now, and in any instance, when you get more and more involved in this IT technology and these devices and programs and installations, every one of them is a prosthetic device that's taking you away from your own natural mind. And it's my understanding that the natural mind of the human species, the mind-body, body-mind-body, I don't just mean the intellectual head-mind, the natural body-mind instrument of the human species is the highest technology on Earth. Your body, your senses, your mind is the highest technology on Earth. So where we have to draw the line is by asking perhaps to what extent, as the Gnostics warned, to what extent are we fascinated and consumed by these artificial technologies of simulation that we create? And to what extent does that remove us and make us oblivious to the innate technology of our own body-mind instruments, which is a technology of telepathy, telekinesis, healing, at a distance, the use of kundalini, the discovery of free energy, machines, levitation? All of these paranormal powers are not exceptional and unusual freak events in human evolution. They are actually the potentials that Sophia engineered into our species for us to develop and explore and own, first of all, to own, then to develop and explore, and as we do so, to use them to create a beautiful world of discovery, novelty, and mutual aid. So, I'm very happy with the internet to the extent that it connects us together, allows us to do what we're doing right here, which is terrific. I'm very happy and I'm extremely grateful that my voice can be heard as on this global radio of the network, of the internet. But as far as the danger of the archons is concerned, it is really present in the internet, that we would make the internet into a kind of a collective mind. The internet is not a noosphere. The internet is not the noosphere. I argued against that claim a couple of years ago when I was writing for Reality Sandwich. It is not the noosphere. The noosphere is the atmosphere, and it is the human mind operating through the atmosphere in a telepathic receiving and sending mode. That's the real noosphere. And for the real noosphere, we don't need this technology. The Australian Aborigines and tribal people around the world, the Inuits, you name them, give us countless examples of how the tribe is connected through their telepathic powers. And this is how the human tribe, the planetary tribe, can be connected. So I would be very wary of the IT if it takes us away from that development and substitutes itself as a more entertaining and more satisfying or more efficient technology. I would be extremely wary of that temptation.
Thank you, John.
Sure.
So, John, this is Lolly.
Sure.
I have a question then about the rise of pornography and sexual exploitation of children. I mean, we see so much pornography on the internet. What can you say about that in terms of the teachings and the Sophia mysteries? Can you address that at all?
Sure, I can. Let me talk first about the sexual exploitation of children. There's nothing more deplorable in my mind than child molesting and pedophilia. And I'll be, you know, frank and honest with you and tell you that in the society that I would like to live in a sane society, anyone who molests or sexually harms a child would be executed, period. You know, these are some of the worst predators, interspecies predators, I call them. And there is absolutely no way that we can live, that we can have a society in which interspecies predators are tolerated, you know, zero tolerance. And because they are tolerated, because they are not treated as brutally as they need to be, in reflection to the brutality that they commit, then we have the sexualization of children all through the media. We allow that, and I absolutely deplore that. I also deplore rape, either of a man or a woman, and to me rape is an act comparable to murder, and in some cases I think should have the same remedy of termination. Terminating predators is a very big issue in the Sophia myth as it's currently unfolding. So get that nasty stuff out of the way before I go on to the sex part. Let's be really clear on that sex with children is just out of the question. Why do these predators have sex with children? They have it because they are preying on human innocence. And innocence is a very, very important value to Sophia, and even more so to Kali. You know, Kali is the wrath of Gaia, you could say. She is that aspect of the divine feminine that represents the wrath of the divine Sophia and the protective wrath. Kali, who is my guardian, is the most powerful protective force on earth. And Kali looks to human beings for the quality of innocence. That is the highest quality that she reveres and seeks in her warriors and those who join her band. And because Kali knows that we were born in innocence. Innocence is the evidence of our divinity. Our innocence is our divinity. We are born from innocence. We are born in innocence. And whatever is destroying that innocence is the part of the human species that itself must be destroyed unconditionally and unequivocally, terminated. So that's my view about sexual abuse of children. Now, if I may go to the second part of the question about sex and pornography, I want to answer this as carefully as possible. And I just want to preface it by saying, first of all, thank you for asking me about pornography. And it's a very important subject. And this is the first time that I've spoken on it and given my view. First of all, I want to say what I'm talking about when I use the word pornography. It covers a vast range of things. I'm not talking about the porn business. I'm just talking, and I'm not talking about child porn, or just talking, let's just narrow it down, and let's say, when I use the word pornography now, I mean photographing or filming consenting adults in sexual acts. That's what I mean by it. That's all. That's one way to look at pornography. A couple of people. And I'm just going to talk about heterosexual, because that's the only thing that I can comment on, because that's the only thing I do. Heterosexual intercourse has, like, a man and a woman or a girl and her boyfriend would have sex, and they would film it and put it on the Internet, which a lot of people do. There's a lot of amateur porn on the Internet, okay? That's what I mean by porn. Why is it so big now? Why is this phenomenon of filming, not even photographs anymore. It used to be skin mags in the 60s. Finally, remember Playboy and Penthouse and those kind of things. Now, we've got film clips of people fucking and doing all of these acts that they do, that many people do without filming it. So why is this happening and why is it overloading the internet? I tell you, I've thought a great deal about this. And I keep going back to something that really haunts me that I tried to understand for many years. There's a text. It's called the Maha Nirvana Tantra. And it's a Sanskrit tantric document written down around 1100 BC. And in this document, you find some intimations of what planetary tantra is today. I take pains to point out on my site that planetary tantra, in both its sexual and non-sexual aspects, is a completely new path of practice for the human species. It's the path that becomes available in the last 200 years of Kali Yuga, which is right now. And so if you go back and you try to look for the lineage or the precedence of planetary tantra, you won't really find much because it's completely novel. But in the Mahanirvana Tantra, you find some hints of planetary tantra as it is emerging today. And one of the things that it says in that document is that in the times of the dark times of Kali, the end of Kali Yuga, which is now, that all people, or many, many people, will practice the Kalika rites of sexual tantra. That is, the type of sexual magic and interactive Gayan magic that is guided, as it were, by Kali. That's called Kalika, K-A-L-I-K-A. So they made this statement over 1,000 years ago. When it gets down to the end of Kali Yuga, many, many people in masses are going to practice these rites. So I thought, this is a really strange. It's not exactly a prediction, but it's, what does it mean? So I'll give you what I've concluded after thinking about this very long and very hard. I think that that statement made 1,000 years ago could be understood in the context of pornography today. I don't mean pornography, the bad aspects of it, white slavery, women being abused, the porn business. I just mean the open demonstration for anyone who wants to see of what people do when they're in the sexual act, oral, anal, everything you can imagine. Why is that being depicted so openly? I think this is what the text was referring to. Now I'm going to add it. I probably should have a disclaimer here, and maybe one of you can make a disclaimer for me. I don't know. But I'm going to add it with my a little word from the Shak goddess, Kali herself. She likes pornography, and she sees pornography as a good thing to the extent that sexual expression is wide open. It's wide open. There's nothing to hide. There's nothing to do in secret. Because when you may perform sexual intercourse with someone in private, and I also prefer to do the same, but it's not a private act, my friend. Sex is not a private act. Because the way that you conduct yourself in the sexual act has tremendous ramifications in your personal life and in society and in the world around you. And so what we're seeing in pornography is the breaking out and the liberation of sexuality. It's not sexual liberation as such. It's the liberation of sexuality. And it's a good thing. I'm telling you, when I was a 14, 15-year-old kid, I couldn't go on the Internet and watch this. But if I could have, I don't know how I would have handled it. I would have needed some help handling it, maybe, but I would have been really grateful to see it, to see how it's done, and to see what can be done. And Kali and Gaia are both very closely aligned on the issue of pleasure. Pornography has the same value as high tantric magic and high Gayan Tantra, which is now coming forth. Because in pornography, at its very best, we see people performing acts simply for the pleasure of doing them, which is the way that sex ought to be performed. simply for the pleasure of doing it. And to heighten that pleasure and to bring it to an art of finesse and intensity and beauty. Now, to a certain extent, I have to say I don't like porn. I don't watch it that much. I watch it once in a while, free porn. I never, would never pay to watch it. I watch it to see what it's like. And I would have to say, at the end of the day, that most of it is beautiful acts done in an ugly way. But nevertheless, they are beautiful acts. These acts of sexual intercourse, these acts of oral adoration, of this licking, this sucking, all of these things that are done, if they are done in innocence and totally for the pleasure of doing them, they become transcendent and sacred acts. And so this is a whole new horizon for sexuality. It is the liberation of the sexual energy into an art of bliss and a healing practice. And the fact that we can see it anytime we want can be helpful. You know, pornography shares the same. Yeah, this is a long answer. I'm going to get off it in a second. But I'll complete with this point. Pornography shares the same motive that sexual Gayan Tantra shares. The motive is when you get together to fuck, you get together to fuck. You get together for the absolute concentration on the pleasure of that act, that it is a sacred ritual, that it is a fantastically beautiful way to love your own body. And that, and at its very best, when you look at, say, an amateur porn clip, I mean, I wouldn't load a clip of me, you know, fucking someone on the internet, but some people do it, and they do it with great innocence. And why are they doing it? Because they want to show the pleasure and celebrate the beauty of what they're doing. And I think that that is fantastically good for our world. And if more people have the kind of sex that you see people having on some of these porn clips, the world would be a much happier place all around.
John, I'd really like to thank you for those thoughtful and honest and courageous comments. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for asking.
Thank you, John, for that. Basically, with the sex in itself is not bad. It's just, it's been twisted. I mean, the destruction of moral values of society. I mean, I heard that a clothing company is mounting a campaign to sell pop-up bras for seven-year-olds. I mean, that's really not the way it is. But on the other hand, sex is a mechanism to procreate, so it's something that I guess Sophia needs in us. So, yeah, that's just my comment.
Let me interrupt you. Sophia is not interested in procreation, and Kali especially is not interested in procreation. In Gayan Tantra and in Kalika's sacred sexuality, there is no procreation. The purpose of the act is for pleasure and not procreation. And this is a really important distinction to make.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
We have a question for Uranus Rising.
Oh, dear. Here we go. I'm back to the Archons after all that wonderful sex. But here we go.
Yeah, the Archons don't have sex. They wish they could, but, you know, they're out of the game. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, too bad for them.
Yes. Right. Carlos Castaneda quoted the sorcerer Don Juan as saying, "The inorganic beings are after our awareness or the awareness of any being that falls into their nets. They'll give us knowledge, but they'll extract a payment, our total being. To live in their world is a voluntary affair, yet they are capable of imprisoning any one of us by catering to our desires, by pampering and indulging us." How does what Carlos Castaneda say here compare or contrast with your understanding of the Archons, the inorganic beings of the Sophia myth?
Well, as I said elsewhere, Carlos Castaneda was sort of a warm-up act for Planetary Tantra. I show on metahistory.org under the Gnostic Castaneda that there are at least 16 very close and in some cases astonishing parallels between the teachings of Castaneda and the teachings of Gnosticism, right down to the assemblage point, which is described in a paraphrase of a lost Gnostic document from a teacher of the School of Alexandria. The assemblage point, the luminous egg, which is called the Ogoides, on and on and on. And certainly, he hit it right between the eyes when he was talking about the archons. It corresponds point by point to the Gnostic description. Of course, Carlos's talk about the archon, inorganic beings is a bit of a, in a broader context. But when you narrow it down to the details, wow. That quote that you just read is exactly what the archons do to us. They are inorganic cyborg beings, a kind of locust-like species that inhabits the solar system at large. They belong to our solar system. They are native to our solar system, but not to the Earth. And they will try to substitute their consciousness for ours. And the way they do that is by tricking us through simulations. So it's brilliant, and you can learn a great deal about Carlos, from Carlos about these archons. When you put it together with the Gnostic stuff, there's no reason why any of these characters should ever bother you again. We can repel them, we can defeat them, we can annihilate them, as I have done on a number of occasions in my life. There's no reason to be afraid of the archons, but the greatest advantage they have over us is our ignorance.
Well, I guess all that reading I did back in the 80s with Carlos Castaneda has paid off. Thank you very much for that, John.
Well, you're very welcome, and it certainly is paying off for many people now, as they are seeing that, as Don Hinero said, all of our magic belongs to her, and it comes from her, meaning the Earth.
Thank you, John. We'll just finish this topic, last couple of questions.
Sure.
I've got a two-part question. My first one was, John, many ancient stories talk about giant, blonde-haired Nordic beings, while others talk about tall reptilian creatures. You mentioned in your previous interviews that Gnostics think the archons are these reptilian beings. Where, then, does these tall, blonde-haired Nordic beings fit into the Gnostic cosmology, and what is the archon reptilian's ultimate plan for humanity?
Oh, boy. This is where we're going to wind up the archons with. Okay, good. First of all, I'm aware of these giants' remains that have been found, these giant skulls, and the big stone chairs in Syria, and all these amazing discoveries. And I would just like to suggest that belongs to the realm of the inexplicable, so John Lash doesn't have the final word on it any more than anyone else. But I would suggest that they were just human beings at earlier stages of our evolution. You know, the human form has been here since sometime after the Cambrian explosion, which would be 580 million years ago. And we have morphed in many ways. And I think when people see these giant skulls and these elongated skulls, and they say, oh, these were the archonic beings. I think they were just former sketches and versions of humanity, you know. Humanity, the Anthropos, according to the Sophia myth, is an open genome engineered in the galactic center. It seeded itself here on Earth, and it spontaneously mutates through different species and subspecies. So I would be very careful about pointing to these artifacts and these giants, you know. There were giants then in the Earth. Well, these giants were human giants, as far as I know. They were earlier remote forms of humanity, and that goes for the tall blondes as well. We don't know anything about our prehistory, almost nothing. We're beginning to get a few clues. Everything we've been told by evolution is wrong. So you have to keep an open mind there, of course, without being too gullible. But the archons were very clear. Let me bring up the R word here. The archons, The Gnostics were very clear about the archons. There are two words in the Nag Hammadi text which describe or hint at the morphological form that the archons take. They do not incarnate in human form. I don't believe that there are archons walking around in human guise on the earth. Speaking as a Gnostic and a reincarnated Telestis, I would warn about that claim. I believe that there are archontified human beings, desensitized zombie freaks. I believe that there are human beings who've completely lost their humanity walking around on Earth. But according to the strict or rigorous view of the ancient seers, there are two forms of archons, an embryonic type, which would match Whitley Strieber's gray ET, and the language in the Gnostic text that gives us this description is the Haibe, H-A-I-B-E, which is a really strange Coptic word, which means aborted fetus. And the other word, so something that looks like an aborted or premature fetus. And the other word they use is Drakon, D-R-A-K-O-N, for a reptilian type. So basically the picture they give us is that the Archons are a locus or hive species of inorganic matter, silicon-based, and that there is a hive, like a drone class, and then there is a reptilian class, which is the overlord or overmind of the Archons, the reptilians. But they do not appear on Earth. They cannot live in the atmosphere of the Earth. They are mind parasites. But they are so adept at HAL, H-A-L, which is, means simulation or mimicry, that they could be considered to be masters of virtual technology, virtual reality. And they can induce in the human mind hallucinations and delusions, which are so convincingly real. This is why they're so dangerous. They're not dangerous in the sense that they're going to invade the Earth. They have no plan. They're mindless and senseless. All they have is an envy of us. They want to be us because we're innocent, playful, and kind. We can do all kinds of things they can't. They envy us. That's called Pthonos. And they also feed off making us afraid. They feed off fear and negative emotions. They vampirize our negative emotions. But they don't have any great plan because they lack what we as a species engineered in the galactic center have, anoia, intentionality. The human species has intentions and the capacity to operate by intention. The Archons are really dangerous because they have no intention. That even makes them more dangerous. It's like if you're driving down the freeway going to Malibu, you know exactly where you're going. You have an intention and you're going to do something when you get there. If there's some wild teenagers in a hot rod driving on the road, they don't have any intention to go anywhere. They just want to drive all over the highway and maybe play bumper cars. That's dangerous. So in that respect, they're dangerous, not because they have a plan, my friends, but precisely because they don't have one.
Thanks, John. So I guess a disease or the Archons are like some sort of possession or spirit that walks into susceptible humans, I guess what you're getting at.
And also just
a quick point. It's interesting that obviously the Kundalini, you think about the snake spiraling across the chakras. So we have to be careful, I guess, if we think of the Archons as reptilians and being bad, then we don't miss out on the fact that it's a function of the Eastern mythology and of getting enlightenment, I guess.
Well, one of the worst errors that's propagated on the Internet concerns the confusion or the lack of distinction between a reptilian, predatory reptilian species and the serpentine power. You know, a snake is not a reptile. You know, a reptile is a lizard, an iguana is a reptile. A snake is a serpent. And the serpentine power is our ally. The Gnostic teachings are absolutely clear on that. You know, Kundalini is what grounds you into the living body of this planet. It's your ground wire. Your Kundalini doesn't take you out of this world. It grounds you into the body of the Divine Sophia. And you can use Kundalini to zap Archons. You can build an immune field around yourself to repel these entities. I haven't had a visit. I used to have a lot of encounters with these Archons in the form of mud shadows, as Castaneda described it, kind of bat-like figures, you know, that would fight with me and attack me in my sleep and in lucid dreams. I had kung fu battles that went on for years with these creatures. I finally learned really how to put them in their place. And the Gnostic teachings tell you exactly how to do this. If you go read a Gnostic catechism on metahistory, you get the exact text. It says when you encounter these soul stealers, these thieves of your soul who abduct souls by night, this is how you deal with them, and it tells you exactly what to do. And so we are not powerless in front of these entities, and the serpent power is our greatest ally. It is the instrument of our divinity, of our capacity for novelty, pleasure, and play, and ought to be celebrated in that spirit and never, never confused with the reptilians.
We're talking to John Lash on metahistory.org, metahistory.org. The next section we'll be discussing with John is Gnosis. Patrick, you've got a question for John.
Yes, John, this may evolve into a discussion of contra-violence, but can you first elaborate on what I view as the ultimate trap for those aware of various control and oppression mechanisms in place, that by recognizing and then vilifying the oppressive religious control, one might ultimately become that which he hates, or as you state, blaming the state of the world on the powers that be, etc., is not the way to make good on the precious legacy of Gnosis. What is the way out of this religious mind trap?
Well, the trap of religion is a deep one, and it was set long ago. As you know, in my book, Not in His Image, I concentrate the first part of the book, the first six chapters, to describing this salvationist virus of the Abrahamic religions, which is really the root of global terrorism, the root of terrorism today. Terrorism is an ideology and a psychic infection, a toxic infection and an ideology. Our species caught that infection from Palestine, and the main trouble in the world still occurs at the very place where the infection went pandemic. Now, violence is inherent in the nature of these Abrahamic religions, no matter how much they may talk about love. It has nothing to do with love, and you have to be an idiot if you can't see that. Love is just used to calm people. Our species is a complicated animal, and because of our divine endowment, including the faculties of Gnosis, which we're going to talk about here, we have an intelligence that is not superior to other animals in nature. I don't like the word superior, but we have an exceptional intelligence. And because we have that exceptional intelligence, characterized by ennoia, intentionality, and epinoia, imagination, we can also go badly, badly wrong. And so we have gone badly wrong in these ideologies of religious salvation and retribution. And the way out of the trap is, first of all, to see them for what they are. And do not try to save them. Do not try to save or salvage them. But have the courage to recognize what they are and to recognize that we must completely abandon them because there is nothing in them worth saving. The religion, if you want one, that can ensure a future, a sane and happy future for the human species, must be a goddess religion exclusively linked to the divinity of the earth. That is the only religion that will work for us. The Gnostic myth is very clear that we are in a dilemma with Sophia, and Sophia is in a dilemma with us. We are a product of her imagination. She's not our creator. We are a product of her imagination, interactive with her, and we together in that interactivity can heal ourselves out of the violence and the delusion that is propagated by these salvationist religions and in the ideology of the divine plan, the Father God, the Messiah, heal ourselves out of the wounding syndrome and the violent syndrome. This we can do and only do through our connection with the earth. So I would say that the solution lies along those lines. As I, when I was reading in your notes, by the way, I'm not quite sure of this warning about becoming what you hate. I don't quite understand that. I certainly can tell you things that I hate. You know, I hate pedophiles, okay? People who molest 4-year-old children or, you know, fuck 12-year-old girls. I hate those people. And I'm not going to, am I going to become one because I hate them? I don't really think so. No. There is a way to hate, and there are things that are worth hating. But it is also a warrior's practice.
I think it's along the lines that religion tends to point you in a direction where you, you know, love thy neighbor, but then kill the guy whose God isn't as good as yours. You end up in a loop.
Yeah, it's a terrible loop. And that's why I say, once you're in the loop, you can't get out, because the one thing reinforces the other. You know, I believe that my analysis of the victim-perpetrator syndrome is the best shot we have. This is the best one I've seen, if I may blow my own horn here. The best shot we have for breaking out of that loop. That's a vicious, vicious loop, you know. The ideology that mixes up calls for love with calls for retribution and complete tolerance, a complete attitude of a complete rejection, excuse me, of coexistence. Complete rejection of coexistence in these religions. So there's a lot to battle against, but and that is, you really have to be a warrior, and a warrior uses all emotions equally as weapons or tools. That includes love, hate, indifference, contempt, compassion, tenderness, brutality. All emotions are tools and weapons of the spiritual warrior.
And I think we'll get more into that. I'd like to go straight into the gnosis part. I'm aware of a past University of Virginia theosophical professor. His name was Walter Russell. And there were several others, possibly Brooks Agnew.
Yeah.
They have experienced a Gnostic download where an actual beam of energy or white light instead of pressed instructions were transferred. And you note in your book that Philip K. Dick had the same experience. And in your discussion, there's a quote, that gnosis consists of disinhibiting instructions to allow us to access a vast store of innate intuitive knowing. This is also referred to as silent knowing in your terms. Can you give us examples of Gnostic instructions and provide any practical means for us to enhance our knowing or gnosis?
Sure. You know, when the Gnostics, by the way, didn't call themselves Gnostics. The word Gnostic just means someone who knows, but it implies someone who knows something really special. But it was used as an insult by the Christian ideologues and fanatics of that time who wanted the Gnostics eliminated and who did eliminate them. So to be called a Gnostikos really meant, oh, a know-it-all and a smart-ass. The Gnostics among themselves call themselves telestai, meaning we who are aimed. And by that they meant intentionally that they are aimed or guided by the Sophia myth. And as a Gnostic or as a telestis would have understood Gnosis, it is the knowledge of things as they can be known directly from the divine source. So, for instance, you could go out in nature and you could decide that you would study, say, geology. And you could read books on geology and you could go out and explore mountains and look at formations of lava. And you could study the natural phenomenon. And in doing so, you might become a competent geologist. One of the great attributes of our species, which makes us exceptional to other species, is our great, great learning capacities. We love to learn, and Sophia loves to teach. You know, her name is Wisdom. So were you to go and learn geology in that manner that I just described, you would become perhaps a competent geologist, but you would not become a Gnostical geologist. If you were to become a Gnostical geologist, you would follow the systematic practice of methesis, which is taking instruction from the divine light, the organic light of Sophia. You would enter into the altered state that allows you to perceive and communicate with that light. And then, in addition to everything that you could learn by the study of nature, looking at rocks, looking at mountains, the formation of tectonic plates, in addition to all that, you could have information directly from the source of all that. This is the absolute beauty and profundity of Gnosis. It is the way to learn about anything from going to the source of learning. And she is the source of learning. And these experiences of Philip K. Dick and other people that you mentioned are typical Gnostic, spontaneous Gnostic experiences. And I've had them myself and have them ongoing, in an ongoing way. I've had them. The Terma of Gaia Awakening, the teachings of Planetary Tantra that I'm transmitting now, come from these kind of experiences, which I have on a repetitive basis. I'm always available to these kinds of experiences. My practice is to be able to enter that state of concentration where the white light downloads. And it is a download, and it comes in a zip file. I got the whole of Planetary Tantra in a matter of 20 seconds. And the nature of this knowledge is very special because it has two aspects which you want to pay close attention to. One of them is, as you mentioned, the disinhibiting instructions. When you encounter this organic light, this teaching, which is a teaching light, you could say, for one thing, it cleanses your mind and it takes away the inhibitions of your programming. It takes away your blindness, and it allows you to see everything in an illuminated way. So it has a disinhibiting or cleansing effect. The second effect it has is that, and that's what silent knowing means. Silent knowing means that normally the inner mental talk that's always going on in your mind, the inner radio that's always playing, it's momentarily turned off. And then the instructions come in that silence. And you hear them just like you hear thoughts in your own mind. You don't hear an external voice. You hear them just like you hear your own thoughts, except they are crystal clear. And they have a quality of lucidity and simplicity about them that distinguishes them from your own thoughts. And my experience has been, in the last 3 years, since I've been continually following this practice, is that the nature of the downloads that Gaia is transmitting now, she transmits on 16 channels, by the way, 16 clairaudient channels, the nature of these downloads is extremely concise and rigorous. I call it Dakini syntax. So she doesn't, in the downpour, in the download, you don't get this blah, 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 blah. It's not like channeling. It must be rigorously distinguished from channeling. People who channel like Jay-Z Knight and all these other people, well, a lot of them, I think, are just frauds and con men, con women. But to the extent that there is some kind of genuine channeling take place, it's prolix. It just goes on and on forever. Whereas the nature of this downloads, of the Gaian downloads from Sophia, are very, very concise and rigorous. And then the challenge is, you're being given a jewel of lucidity, a jewel of thought, a jewel of realization. This is called a Dakini elixir, a jewel elixir. And then the challenge is to actually live and practice that elixir and integrate it into your experience. And this is an absolutely fantastic path that is now opening to us as Gaia awakens and she is reaching toward us because we are part of her solution and part of her correction.
Right. It, as I understand through your reading, it's not about letting your mind go blank for silent knowing.
No. Your
Psychonautics webpage discussed the organic light and how it requires some sort of focused attention.
It does indeed.
Right.
That's right. It does. In fact, the practice of telestic shamanism, the telestic is from the word telos, T-E-L-O-E-O-S, which means a name. Telestic shamanism, which was the practice of the pagan seers in the mysteries, is very simply this. While you're in your ordinary state of rational thinking and logic and intellect, which Castaneda called the first attention, while you're in that state and you're sitting around with a group of your buddy shamans, you define a name. You define the name, say, I want to go to the organic light and I want to explore the nature of fire. Just an example. Or I want to know about the oak trees. What is an oak tree? What is the properties of an oak tree? You form a specific aim, which is often the aim to learn something. And you form that before you go into the state. So then, when you're in the practice, there is a carryover. Then when you find yourself in the altered state, standing and encountering the organic light, you retrieve your question and you put it to the light. This is called telestic shamanism because it is a directed form of shamanism with a specific intention.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. Next time I try it, though, I'm going to make sure my wife's out of town.
Sure.
John, just a quick question. Basically, we did speak to a gentleman by the name of Leonard Horowitz yesterday, and he's obviously got some interesting ideas on regards to the six solfeggio frequencies. I was wondering, when you were talking about the actual methods, could they have something to do with how this transmits into our medium, you know, the 528 hertz frequencies, etc.?
Yeah, it could. And, in fact, that just came up to me the other day. I hadn't heard about this 528 hertz. But I'm going to investigate it, and there's a chance that it may fit into the picture here. I'll tell you what I know at present, okay? I know that Gaia is transmitting to us as if through a radio console of 16 channels. And you can hear each one of these channels. It's more, her communication is more a clairaudient one. So you can hear and register each one of these channels. Pick it up with your own antenna, as it were. And I haven't investigated it at this point. I've been communicating with the channels and showing other people how to do the same with, a pretty good rate of success so far. I haven't investigated how these channels might be described in terms of hertz frequencies, but I would be happy to do that very soon.
Thank you, John. The next question we have is from Uranus Rising.
Sure.
John, you've written that the Gnostics rejected the Persian duality of good and evil, but instead had their own theory, that of error. This theory suggests that we evolve by learning, especially learning by our mistakes. And there is a wide latitude for error, which typifies human singularity. That by allowing our mistakes to go undetected and uncorrected, our singularity becomes destructive. But given that most people are so immersed in the archonic intra-psychic influence that causes error to run wild and to live in the false belief that the ego is God and that we should be perfect, it sets us up to fear our errors as they feel like a death. So would you briefly but properly explain the Gnostic theory of error for us? And my question is there anything to offer to those of us who are caught in that archonic intra-psychic dynamics of good and evil, especially if they find themselves in the states of fight, flight, or being frozen from fear?
Wow. This is so deep and so critical. So critical to the threshold, or the precipice, I guess would be a better word, where the human species now finds itself. As for a paraphrase of the Gnostic theory of error, I commend you. I mean, you gave a brilliant paraphrase, and you got in all the key points. When we were engineered and conceived as a product of the imagination of Sophia in the galactic core, before this divine potential of humanity was seeded in the limbs so that it could emerge in a range of planetary settings, Sophia and the other aeons encoded into us a high factor of monogenes. That's the Greek word, monogenes. Singularity. And you say beautifully, one of the features of our singularity is that we are a learning species. We're a storytelling species and a learning species. And we have what makes us different, not superior, to whales and iguanas and bees and snails and slugs and tigers and elephants and horses, is that all those other animals have a limited instinctual singularity. They have a limited singularity defined by their instinctual format. So within their instinctual formats, monarch butterflies, for instance, who fly up and down the coast of California down to Mexico and back, or birds that migrate here across the Straits of Gibraltar down into Africa to exact places, almost the same trees, and then navigate back again to Europe. How can they do that? Because Gaia, who is the mother of those species, the creator, artistic creator, gives them a singularity, but it is restricted to a very narrow scale, field of operation, and therefore their behavior is, in a sense, more perfect than ours. They don't have a margin for error. We have a huge margin for error, and that's where we get in trouble. And as you said, the essence of this Gnostic theory of error is so brilliant. We need to make mistakes, because in seeing our mistakes, we correct ourselves. And that's how we really learn. Learning is a self-correction process. But if we allow our errors to go undetected, they extrapolate beyond the scale of correction. And we go nuts. And we become destructive. And we totally lose it. And we do things like construct 55 nuclear power plants on the most earthquake-prone zone in the world. This is what we do. And millions of other things. We would be exhausted giving the examples. You bring up such an important point, and I've not had anyone raise this before. What can we do about the fact that people are so terrified to admit their mistakes? You know, I just had an incident, this happens to me all the time. I just had an incident with someone in a personal relationship, someone I saw for a few months as a friend, 2 or 3 months, and then the relationship ended, which is fine with me. You know, nothing lasts forever, and I expect relationships to begin and end, and a relationship of 2 months or 2 weeks or 2 hours with a human being can be rich and rewarding. The fact that it ends does not detract from that. But it ends badly when someone is not able to admit that they made mistakes. There's no way to correct the relationship. There's no way, there's no closure. There's no way to go on with a healing attitude. I mean, it makes it very, very difficult to pull out of those kind of situations. And as you suggest, humanity at large is in this situation where people who are unwilling to admit their own wrong or their own errors or mistakes are not going to be able to see it in others. You know, when they see it in the government, in the authorities, by the way, Archon is another word for authorities. Authorities is another translation for Archon, by the way. When they see the authorities doing things which are clearly wrong, in error, insane, harmful, and they don't go and confront the authorities on their error. I don't really have an answer except to tell you a kind of supernatural answer. But before I give you that, I'd like to make a Gnostic qualification. When I give you a supernatural answer, it doesn't mean that I'm asking you to take anything on faith. It means that from my experience, I understand that certain things that are happening and can happen with the human species depend on a supernatural input into our reality. We are interacting with the supernatural. Don't ask you to take that on faith. For me, it's a matter of fact. And for you, it can be fact as well. You can verify what I'm saying. Supernaturally, there's a selection process happening right now, and it's rigorous. There is not going to be a collective or mass awakening, as far as I can tell. There never has been. If you're looking for a quantum shift to flood through the human species, I suppose it could happen. We're a species of novelty and singularity. It could happen. I won't rule it out. But there's one thing that I can assure you is happening, and that is that the Dakini forces of Gaia, she has these Dakini energies or frequencies, are selecting from the human species those who can merge into Gaia's correction and those who can't. And I hate to sound like an eugenicist, and please give me a lot of slack here, folks, because I'm not a eugenicist, and I don't believe in the concept of culling the human race, but there is a kind of splitting of the ways taking place. The Hopi prophecy is one of the few indigenous teachings that I would cite that might help us to understand Gaia's correction. And the Hopi prophecy says that human reality splits into two realities which go in two completely different directions at the same time. And so there is no way that you and I, as human beings, are ever going to sort this out. I can't even have a moment of truth with another person. I mean, that's all I want. I don't want much from the human species or any other person, man or woman. I just would like to have, I would like to reach you in total naked honesty and have a moment of truth with you. That's what I seek from every person that I meet. And let me tell you, I don't get much of it. So I don't burden myself with this syndrome of fear and this deplorable, shabby behavior of human beings that they cannot admit their mistakes. I don't burden myself with that. I attempt to raise my mind to the impeccable solution of the goddess herself, to live in her wisdom and to follow her selection.
Thank you very much, John. That is very much in line with not only my experience as a Langian psychotherapist for many years in the past, but also my own personal experience.
Fantastic. Langian, fantastic.
Yes.
Lang was a great, great visionary. And boy, he tested everything that he, every idea, he went through it himself. And what he told us in the Politics of Experience, I have quoted many, many times, that the worst thing that can happen to a human being is that you can take away from them their very capacity to have their own experience. And unfortunately, this is the fate that has befallen the human race, largely through the archontic con and through religion and deviant spirituality. And, he was a great initiate of schizophrenia and brought a great healing understanding out of his own ordeals. Much to teach us about how to face this this situation.
Thanks, John.
Sure.
Thanks, Uranus. Thanks, John. Next question is from Patrick.
Yes, John, along the lines of supernatural awakening, I think we need to discuss mushrooms and other psychoactive natural plants that have been around for a millennia. How important is the psychonautic experience in seeking to finish the unfinished animal, as you put it? Can we get there intellectually without having to surf the tide that Terence McKenna was famous for? I don't have to be in an altered state to see that culture's not my friend.
No, you certainly don't. You certainly don't. And I would say that... I love this question, and I'm so glad that it came up, because it just gives such a great shape to this whole discussion that we're having here, with the shape and the veracity of our discussion would be missing something without this question. So if you just give me like 5 minutes here, I'm going to fire off on a couple of points. First of all, I'm just going to give you my understanding of what the psychoactive plants are as I got it from Sophia herself. What she taught me in the first experiences and encounters I had on Infinity Ridge here in Spain in around 2002 and 2003 was absolutely momentous when I had the breakthrough and I realized that in a trance state of heightened attention, I could actually communicate with the planet and receive instruction from her poured into my own mind as a pristine language. I was in total ecstasy. And I had some really fantastic moments with her, and she was able to instruct me in some of the really essential fundamental factors of her correction. And the subject of psychoactive plants came up in those conversations with Gaia, as it did also in the people who were around me at the time. She told me that the existence of the psychoactive plants, the psycho plants with psychomimetic chemistry on Earth is no accident of the plant world, and it's not just a game that she plays. She didn't create them just for the fun of doing it. As she is an artist, everything she does, everything she creates from a seahorse to a daisy to Mount Everest is an object of great beauty. There is intention in the beauty that she creates. And she told me that the intention of these psychoactive plants was very specific for aiding the human species. We now know that there are about at least 200 species of these plants, as estimated by Schultes in the book and Hoffman in the book Plants of the Gods. Let's say 200 or more species of plants that have a particular relation to nitrogen in the atmosphere. They use nitrogen in a way that doesn't appear to be necessary for their survival. And so scientists and botanists have been puzzled by this. But she says, these plants are corrective to our insanity, which itself is due to the great latitude of freedom that we have. Unlike other animals, we have more freedom to invent and discover, but also more freedom to make mistakes to the point of becoming insane due to our errors. Is that clear enough?
Yes, it is. I also understand they used to use it for alcoholics and other ills.
Well, they're using it now. You know, ayahuasca and iboga and other psychoactive plants that were used for countless thousands of years are now being used to cure addictions. So this is a new breakthrough. But Gaia provided them because she recognized that the human species would have trouble with the archons. She recognized that we would have this problem of correcting our own errors. Although it is our greatest gift to make errors, it is our greatest liability to not be able to detect those errors and correct them. See, that in a nutshell is our dilemma. And so these plants are provided as brain medicine. And as you know, they are psychomimetic or cerebromimetic. That is to say that they don't do anything for you except enhance the properties that are already operating in your brain. They enhance the electrochemistry of the brain, and they put it up on turbo. So when you go on turbo, you go right out of your program, of your operating system, as Terence McKenna calls it. You clean out, psilocybin mushrooms will clean out your operating system, put you into silent knowing, and then they'll take you right to the organic light. That's their job. They're emissaries. They are teachers in their own right. You can learn things, say, from Psilocybe cubensis that would be different from what you would learn from ayahuasca or from Psilocybe tampanensis or something like that. Each of these species has their own particular properties and personalities. They are genial species. They communicate with us by actually joyriding in our nervous systems. When you ingest these mushrooms in the proper manner, they actually take over your nervous system and your brain, and they drive it for you. And they're able to drive it a lot better than you are. And so they will take you to the organic light, and they were used in the mysteries and used in indigenous settings all around the world for thousands and thousands of years exactly for that purpose. So if you had asked me, can you get there without them, I would say, no, I don't think so. Given the state of the human mind, it's much easier to get there with them. They are provided for us for that purpose. They are harmless. They are non-addictive. And so why not use the tools that Gaia provides to overcome our disability? Having said that, though, I want to add this little point. Terence McKenna wonderfully said that in an indigenous society, the shaman is the person that the society allows to go out of it and then come back again. You see, that's like me. It's like me. I'm a Nahual, which is a practitioner of shamanic trance, a Nahual and a shaman. And I don't live in a tribal society, unfortunately. I wish I did. I don't live in a community. I don't even have an entourage of 3D people around me. But if I did, you might be one of them. And you wouldn't necessarily have to go in and out of the supernatural. You see, because the rule for a sane community, a sane tribal society, is that some of its members do that. They're the shamans and seers who investigate the supernatural. They're the ones who go consult with Gaia on problems of water, of things that concern the health and sustainability of the community. But the secret is, not a secret, the requirement is that such people like myself would have to be honored and respected by the tribe in which they live. So, not everyone in the tribe, including you, has to eat these mushrooms and go into these trances, but you will respect and honor the people that do. And there would be a recognition of their role, and those people, the shamans of the community, would come back to the community and share what they learned. And that is what keeps a community in connection with the supernatural and saves it from being suffocated by the limits of human culture. That's what allows a community to renew itself.
I agree totally. Unfortunately, we're kind of upside down in our society.
Well, we have been for a while. You know, these Abrahamic religions, these conquering salvationist religions of the Sephardic Father God, look at what's the first thing they do when they get to any place? What's the first thing the conquistadors did when they came to the New World, as I describe in my book? They saw a paradise. They saw people who were generous, open, and innocent, even though they were ferocious warriors when they needed to be. Columbus himself wrote with perplexity in his journal, I can't figure out what these people are so happy about, you know? And what did they do to those people? You see? So we don't have a society today. We don't have societies today that recognize someone like myself and Terence McKenna as an important counterbalance in culture that can go out of the social paradigm and come back to it again, sadly. And boy, that is one reason why we're in such a mess. It's a big, big reason in my view.
I agree. Thank you, John.
Sure.
Odison, you have a question for John.
Hi.
Yeah.
So this is on behalf of Bluebird, one of our members.
Sure.
John, at what point do you think we as a culture recognize that LSD in particular was not a mind control agent, but rather a consciousness expanding path? And would you today advocate its use?
Well, yeah, I would advocate the use of LSD as a kind of trainer wheels. You know, when you were learning to ride a bicycle, sometimes you would put trainer wheels on the back if you couldn't balance, so you would get comfortable with the idea of riding this bicycle. And then when you were comfortable enough, you just unscrew the trainer wheels, and there you go. You can encounter the organic light with LSD. I have done it myself, and I have done it in the presence of a couple of other people. So even though it is a synthetic chemical, because of the purity of its composition and the extraordinary properties it has to surf across the synapses, LSD is, I believe, good LSD, pure, is a safe and reliable way to start experiencing or exploring these trance states and the trance attention that will take you to Gaia and take you to interactivity. I tell you, in the 60s, I took LSD for the first time in Madras, India, when I was 19. I came back to New York at the height of the psychedelic era.
In 1965 and 1966, I had the good fortune to be able to experience pure Sandoz LSD. And I used to take quite massive doses of it at the time. Fortunately, it was easy to purchase, and the conditions of the trade in LSD were trustworthy. I can tell you that what I experienced was not merely a business transaction. I remember very clearly the first time in the Lower East Side of New York when I went to an apartment and handed someone a $5 bill, and they placed a Sandoz tablet in my hand, and the person selling me this tablet looked me straight in the eyes and said, "May you see the white light, and may you be part of the revolution." So that was no simple business transaction that I was having there. And many, many of us at the time were clear that the implications of the LSD experience were momentous, and we undertook it in a pure and innocent way. It's only later that I learned that it was used for devious purposes, that the CIA was giving it to people without their knowledge and experimenting with mind control. But during the time, the heyday of the 60s, we had an ideal situation for opening our consciousness, and we really believed that by doing that one person at a time, we would change the world.
Okay, we're speaking with John Lash, and the next topic we're up for discussion is religion. Odison, can you please ask John your question?
Sure. I heard your analogy of Christianity as a virus and the human mind as a computer. In case you're not aware, there are multiple operating systems that run on the same computer hardware. Typically, viruses are program or operating system specific. In my case, I think of my human operating system as a frame of reference specific, rewritten by me to some degree. What are your thoughts on Abrahamic religions as multi-tiered religions? As a most positive example, one religion to control the philosophically challenged, and another to protect those seeking enlightenment from them.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying about the tiered system?
No, I don't get the last part. Nor do I get the part about protection.
Basically, what I'm saying is that. You know, I'm extending the computer analogy to say that there are people who are philosophically, for whatever reason, I'm not trying to judge, for whatever reason, are incapable of seeking any kind of philosophical enlightenment.
Right.
And then there's another group of people who may or may not want to seek enlightenment, and that the Abrahamic religions could possibly be an example of a tiered religion protecting one group from the other. Keeping the philosophically challenged, the unable to be philosophical, safe, keeping them away from the people who actually want to be philosophical explorers. And not just Abrahamic, the way I framed the question, it could apply to any religion that feared. Does it make more sense?
I'm still not sure if I follow you, but I would say that the success of the Abrahamic religions and these belief systems, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, largely resides on the fact that there are many people who are so lazy and stupid that they don't investigate their own minds, and they just don't have the disposition to look for truth themselves, so they will just accept any crap that someone gives them, depending on how it's wrapped up, you know, how it's packaged. So to a large extent, these Abrahamic religions are customized. They are designed to be fed to people who lack the desire for self-investigation and who lack a desire to seek their own enlightenment. That's pretty obvious, I think.
Okay. Do you think that all external savior religions are doomed to become dogma-based multi-tier control structures?
I think that all savior religions are delusional, that they're toxic, and that they represent a dangerous pathology that has infected the human mind for over 2,000 years. So I think that the reason we are reaching the point of abscess, this toxic ideology of the Messiah is now abscessing. And the abscess is an ugly thing to watch, but the abscess has to be released in order for the pus and the poison to be released. And only when the abscess is when a doctor takes I've seen them do this to a friend of mine once. And a doctor takes a sharp scalpel and just punctures that abscess. It's an extremely painful moment, but that's when healing can happen after that. But it cannot happen as long as this abscess is operating. And the Messiah complex is like that. It's like an abscess in the psyche of the human species.
There is no Messiah. There never has been a genuine Messiah, and there never will be a Messiah, yet it is a powerful tool for controlling people, the belief in this messianic entity.
And scare them.
I would definitely agree that it scares them.
And give them false hope, you know?
Yes. Alright, so as a second follow-up, the contrary, kind of almost the opposite religious or faith system, in a self-directed spiritual agenda, isn't there a risk of complete abandonment of morals for self-gratification? Kind of like staring at a wall of mirrors.
Why? No.
Why would there be a complete abandonment of morals?
Are you inferring that human beings are so constituted in their emotional, mental, and moral makeup that if they're not threatened with a set of rules to follow from an off-planet god who will punish and torture them if they don't follow the rules, then they won't behave out of kindness and the spirit of coexistence? Is that what you're inferring?
No, not at all. I was referring to, think of it this way, as like a friend going to a friend and having them give you advice about something that you've been doing that's been hurting the people around you or offending them. And if you go on a journey completely on your own and you don't have that friend, you may not get to that point. I'm not trying to broaden that past that frame of reference.
Right. Well, let me just say this. The One of the really destructive and delusional factors of these Abrahamic religions is that they posit the off-planet Father God, like I say, and they make the human species, they put the human species into a state of slavish reliance upon this Father God. But of course, many people go for that because they don't have enough self-reliance. Now, I'd like to make this point really clear. The path of planetary tantra, or the Gayan Tantras, and the religion, if you want to call it that, that we would have with Sophia as the central figure, is also a state of dependence. And so you're never alone. And you could not possibly be alone or just relying completely on yourself if you have the connection to Sophia. Something I've been saying recently, and this has been discussing this with a group of people I'm working with, if you really make the connection with the planet, the divine indwelling presence of Sophia, one of the first things that you realize is that you don't even have a life of your own. The idea that you have a life of your own is an illusion. Separation is an illusion. When you make the connection to her, you realize that you have a life of your own potential, but that it's meaningless unless it's framed in her life. The very air you is in your lungs right now comes from her. The very cells in your body, you know? And so there is a dependence and interactivity that we can realize with the planet. That's the solution. But the slavish dependence and the mindless adoption of beliefs of these religions is an illness that's taking down our species if we don't break out of it. Hope that's helpful.
So it sounds, just to clarify, it sounds like you're comparing the difference between a boss-employee relationship and a driver-passenger relationship. Is that accurate?
In a way. Certainly, we're not talking about a boss-employee relationship, but I'll tell you if I may use the metaphor that I'm adopting more lately, I'll try it out on you folks and tell me what you think. Consider that the Earth, the planet Earth, is a big mothership. It's a big ocean liner sailing through the galaxy, sailing in the galactic limbs. And consider that the unique thing about this ocean liner is that the designer of the ocean liner, who also planned the journey, is the captain. And the captain is on board. So we're on an ocean liner, which was designed by the captain, and the captain is on board, and the captain is Gaia. So this is how it works. Look at what happens. How does an ocean liner sail? Well, there is a crew and there are passengers.
And so you can choose a planetary tantra, and interactivity with Gaia is a self-elective process. You can choose to be a passenger and just sail along on the great mothership of the planet, or you can choose to be a member of the crew.
So I would say pilot and crew is the metaphor that would I feel comfortable with that really expresses our relationship to her. And it even gets better, because if you want to be in the navigational part of the crew, that's really interesting, because that means that you are involved with a pilot in plotting the course of the ship. So those are the kind of relationships that I would suggest to imagine, if that metaphor is helpful.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Good.
So here's a kind of the ultimate heretic question for you. What are your feelings and thoughts on inventing a religion for the purpose of passing information across generations of humans? And the people in the WebBot Project will specifically recognize this as a kind of an idea that's been tossed around on the possibility that vast amounts of humans are facing imminent death, and that the information about what we've learned from the Mayans and such about the nature of the sun and may be lost if care isn't taken. So it's actually a practical, technical problem. I'm looking at it.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Well, it's a... You've got your work cut out for you there.
Yeah. I didn't say it would be easy, and I didn't say it would be right. I was curious what you thought.
Do you know why the pyramids are such a bitch? You know, we can't get the fucking pyramids out of our minds, you know? The image of the pyramid, with the eye in the pyramid. You know why that's such a bitch? It's not because it's the symbol of a master race of Satanists who are mind controlling us, you know. I don't buy that scenario. I think there are predatory control freaks running the military and running governments and the banking system. I mean, that's obvious. But I wouldn't elevate them to the power of occult masterminds. So their symbol is the eye in the pyramid, right? The symbol of the Illuminati. The symbol of the globalist controllers, right?
Yes.
But that's not really why it's such a bitch, you know. It's really such a bitch because when we go and look at the pyramids are, the image of a pyramid is imprinted in the human mind. And everybody who's seen them, either seen them up physically, been there, is all the better if you've physically been there, is actually has the same reaction, the same response. When you stand there in front of the pyramids, what the average human being does is it doesn't think, oh my God, these were built by the Illuminati and the Illuminati are still around and look at what they're doing to us. No. You just look at the damn things and you scratch your head and you say, how in the fuck were they ever made? And then you say, what on earth were they made for? You know? And so the pyramids create the same impression on every human being. Bafflement. They are a riddle. And this riddle comes around very closely to what you are suggesting to me here about the WebBot project of preserving knowledge. Why are we baffled when we look at the pyramids? Because we don't know. The knowledge of how they were made and what they were made for has been lost, you know?
Yes.
Countless people have tried to explain how they were made. Countless people have tried to explain what they were used for. You want to hear my explanation? I may as well pitch in mine.
Sure.
Okay. Here goes. I think that they are psychic, electrical acoustic devices. I think that they were constructed using acoustic properties, anti-gravitational properties, or anti-gravitational technology of acoustics, and that they were constructed to provide electricity and other forms of energy to the Nile Valley because there was a very unique experiment, a social experiment going on in the Nile Valley for several thousands of years, and that's a long story in itself. But I believe that the Egyptians had electricity, they had wireless transmission, and I believe it was a power station. And I believe that, in a sense, it was a solution to the free energy problem, the free energy riddle. So we've got a real big problem today. Because we don't have free energy, or if we do, the men and women who discovered it have been repressed and murdered. So we have the enigma of the pyramid in front of us all the time, not as a symbol of the triumph of the Illuminati, but as a symbol of a great challenge for the divine experiment from Gaia's point of view, from her point of view, as Sophia would have it. She would like us to discover free energy and use it to make the world, to make our world on Earth, to make our habitat. Free energy is really important to her conception of our success as a species. And in addition to that, if we were able to do that, of course we would turn the situation around, the whole world situation around in 2 weeks. But in addition to that, we would have another responsibility, precisely the one that you are suggesting. We would have to find a way to preserve for future generations the knowledge of how to do that. And that is part of her correction. That is part of our future. If we can do that, you don't have to make a religion out of it. Make an institution out of it. The mysteries were institutions of learning, and they preserved and passed down a great deal of knowledge. But you know what happened to them, don't you?
Yeah, that's part of that technical problem.
Yeah, all of their books.
A lot of roadblocks by local and leaders local to a particular time and place. If the message contained within the capsule or the message written on the wall or such isn't suit them, they blow it up or rip it down.
Yeah.
And then the bigger message for humanity is lost.
In the libraries of the classical world, all the libraries, ancient Greece, Iberia, which is now Spain, everywhere you can imagine, there existed every form of astronomy, astrology, the true Sophianic myth of the cosmos, free energy physics, volumes on music and mathematics and healing, and every form of wonderful creative knowledge you can imagine. And all of that was deliberately destroyed down to the last flake
by these predatory control freaks. So obviously, if we pull out of this battle, and it is a war, it's not a war of my wanting, but it's a war I accept, you know? If we pull out of this battle with the predatory control freaks, we have to find a way to preserve knowledge in case that would ever happen again, or in case there would be natural catastrophes that would destroy the repositories of knowledge, you know? Big, big, big responsibility there.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Edison. Yeah, and obviously we've got stuff like the Voynich manuscripts, but unfortunately nobody knows how to decipher them. The next question we have is from Patrick.
Sure.
Yeah, John, we're going back into religion. I found Derek Jensen's afterword in your book, not in his image, a great summary. And I appreciate it, as he did, in the terms of the movie Avatar, and why it makes sense to cast off much of what religions have to offer as underlying benevolent themes. This becomes clear in your statement and your discussion that there are just three sayings of Jesus that epitomize what is truly unique in the message of Christianity. And as well, you suggest they permeate other religions. And these are thoroughly compressed from Matthew 5. Number one, turn the other cheek. Number two, love thine enemy. And number three, thou art blessed if men revile and persecute thee. Can you elaborate and contrast these parables with your understanding of indigenous or Gnostic moral concepts?
Sure. You know, paganism is just another name for indigenous people. Pagan means a country dweller. The pagan world was the world of Europe before Christianity wiped it out. And paganism has nothing to do with Satanism and animal sacrifice or human sacrifice. And every time I hear someone like David Icke or Michael Tesarian saying, or Alex Jones or whoever you want to name, saying that the mind control predator psychotics who are running the planet are Satanists and they practice pagan rites, I get a bit irritated, you know. They don't practice any pagan rites. Paganism, the ethos of paganism and of indigenous peoples is the strongest possible contrast to that stuff you find in the New Testament. I've often said, if you read Marcus Aurelius, he states in his Meditations, the primary understanding of pagan ethics, love truth. This is one of the principles of pagan ethics. Love truth. Love what is true. Love to tell the truth. Love to know the truth. Love truth. He also says that the divine so constituted human beings as to be disposed to help each other. So, mutual aid is part of our nature. Coexistence is part of our nature. That does not mean tolerance of anything, but it means peaceful coexistence and intolerance against that which threatens our peaceful coexistence. And as you know, Christianity had to wipe out the mysteries and wipe out paganism because they could not coexist with it. Why not? Because if they had, if Christianity would never have succeeded. Because the truth of the pagan mystery teachings and the Sophianic vision is so beautiful and natural. It speaks to our heart, speaks to our genetic memory, tells us who we are. It's so wonderful that if it had been available as an option, Christianity would never have taken root in people's minds. So the contrast could not be any stronger. The counsel to love your enemies comes from your enemies. Chew on that one before you go to bed. The counsel that says turn the other cheek and resist not evil, which is about the sickest message that ever came down the pike, comes from the doers of evil. Resist not evil is a message from the doers of evil. So if you can't see this, you're really in trouble. Really in trouble. And yet, people who can see that, and I have a certain amount of compassion for them, not much, but people who can begin to see that these teachings of, so-called teachings of Jesus are hideous mind control formulas, and they're lies, and they're twisted and perverted. People who can see that still have a problem, because it's like they've been walking around on crutches all their life. But they don't need crutches, but they've been using crutches. Now you go and you take these crutches away from them, or you ask them to lay down their crutches, and they're not going to be able to walk very well at first. And so, because they don't think that there's any other morality outside of a dictatorial morality that's given from an off-planet god. And so they have to, one way or another, have the grace of Sophia to lead them into the indigenous goodness of the human spirit. And that's the only way they can find their way back into their own humanity.
No, I understand. And people embrace what's in the Bible, and it makes them very easily controlled.
Yes.
In that regard. In your book, Not in His Image, I think it was on page 90, you stated, while it appears to be a commission from God, the summons to perfection is in reality a call to madness and self-annihilation. And later on, something to the effect that a religious meme that sanctifies violence and guarantees the righteous vindication of its victims is hard to beat.
Yeah.
Can you describe how this is embedded in each of the Abrahamic religions?
Well, sure. I mean, that's what the first five parts of my book, first five, six chapters of my book are about. And I wouldn't want to try to reiterate all of that here, but I would just return to the essential point. When you deconstruct these belief systems of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, what you find in them are formulas for a victim-perpetrator bond. Victim-perpetrator bond. That is, that they are mainly scripts cleverly and deceptively written, disguised as a message of love and a message of our connection to the Creator. But actually they contain formulas that entrain people to a victim-perpetrator bond. They give the victims a sense of righteousness. They give the victims a sense of superiority because the victims are told to love the people who are perpetrating on them. And the perpetrators, in their own turn, have the sanction of God to do this perpetration. It's a very twisted, sick system. And the reason why the Messiah
is such a bad idea
is because the Messiah always carries this Tzaddik component. The word Tzaddik from Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, Tzaddik, it's a letter of the Hebrew alphabet, means the perfect or the righteous. As long, and this is where they really hook people, you know. Instead of giving people the message of paganism, which is, you're all basically good, and now go practice your goodness, your natural goodness, and you'll get better at it as you practice it. You know, you can make mistakes, and there are some bad people. Some people go bad. Perfectionism is inherent in these religions, a sense of perfectionism, and that creates guilt, and people can be controlled through guilt. Whereas the pagan option is to say, No one has to strive for perfection. There was never a totally perfect human being, such as Jesus Christ is put up to be, and there never will be. Just own or recognize your natural goodness and practice it, and you'll get better at it. And if you make mistakes, you'll learn from your mistakes. And if there's anyone who will not practice the natural goodness of humanity and deviate from it, well, we'll take care of them. But we're not going to forgive them and tolerate them and thank them for the harm they do.
Thank you for that, John. Appreciate it.
Sure.
My last question in this series, I'm going to refer to the book Valis by Philip K. Dick.
And yeah, he had
a running theme, the empire never ended. He suggests that we've been stuck in some type of time loop since the first century, starting in 70 CE. Perhaps we're replaying the same storyline. And as you say, the empire is threatened by zealot movements and religious terrorism. Can you discuss how history's been repeating itself and also the significance of 70 CE?
Well, yeah, 70 CE was when Titus barged into Rome and drove the Jews out of Rome. And, you know, so the Jews then have been spread all around the world, which is actually very good for them. They act very well, and they contribute beautifully to many of the cultures where they've been assimilated, you know, ancient Hebrews. They were, after all, a nomadic people. But, of course, that event of Titus driving the Jews, expelling the Jews from Palestine, was in a momentous moment, as Philip Dick knew. First of all, you have to understand why that was done. And I explain it very clearly in my book why that was done. It's because, in large measure, the Jewish community, the Hebrew or ancient Jews, Hebrews of the Middle East, comprised as much as 15% of the population of the Roman Empire, the Semitic population. And they were coexisting, for the most part, with the other pagan religions. They all had a good life together. It is true that the ancient Hebrews had a very particular religion and codes of behavior that they followed, but they didn't evangelize it and push it on anyone else. So out of that 15% of the population of the Roman Empire, most of it concentrated in Egypt and the Near East, most of those Semitic peoples wanted to coexist with peoples of other races and faiths. But there was a small sect of ultra-fanatical, xenophobic, and genocidal Jews called the Tzaddikim. And they were very destabilizing to the Roman Empire because they wanted to overthrow the Roman occupation of Palestine because they had this religious agenda which carried forth today in Zionism. And so it got so bad, I mean, they would even torture and murder their own people, these zealots. The first crucifixions, the counts of crucifixions, were Jews crucifying other Jews. They were very dangerous people, and the mainstream Jewish people of that time, if I might use that expression, were afraid of them. And yet, they caused so much trouble and destabilization in Rome, you can read all about this story in my book, that the Roman emperor finally decided to use the draconic measures. And said, well, these people are spies. They hide among good, decent people. There are only maybe one zealot in 1,000 people, but we don't know which one it is, so we're going to get all of them to help them get them out of here. And that's why the Jews were expelled from Palestine, because of a problem in their own midst, not because they themselves presented a danger. We can see the parallel today. I mean, it's clear as a bell. In that same region today, a tiny amount of people are being used as a pretext to destabilize the entire world. And yet at the same time, the measures that are taken against that destabilization are horrific political and military campaigns. This is the great Zionist con, which goes all the way back to this Tzaddikim movement. So Philip K. Dick had an acute historical awareness, and he recognized that we are replaying this myth today. This is a social myth. And he also recognized that, you know, the Roman Empire is the model of a police state. In its worst aspect, it had some good aspects, but in its worst aspect, it was a model of fascism and a police state. And he realized that we are today living in the same, under the same threat of fascism as occurred at the height of the Roman Empire.
Thank you, John.
Sure.
Lolly, you have a question for John?
Mm-hmm. John, these are two questions from forum member Lauren.
Sure.
Okay. Cliff High cites L. Austin Waddell's research in stating that our word for God derives its religious meaning from a Sumerian word that actually means master, as in he, who disciplines his slaves. Mm-hmm. From my research, it appears the Sumerian word for God is Diger. Do you have any insight on the etymology of the word God? If not, would you be able to speak about the role of the Sumerian gods Enki and Enlil, as I don't believe your book mentions them?
Sure. First of all, be aware that there are many, many names for gods or divinities in mythologies all around the world, male and female names. In fact, there are many more female names, perhaps 1 to 100 at least.
And as a comparative mythologist who's examined the myths and legends of cultures all around the world, I can assure you that there's a vast richness of names. But there is a very interesting anomaly that occurs coming out of the Semite and Sumerian culture. And that is something that Joseph Campbell pointed to brilliantly. You know, he wrote The Mass of God, which are these four volumes, Creative Mythology, Occidental Mythology, Oriental Mythology, and Primitive Mythology, I think. And in one of them, I think it would be Occidental Mythology. He's talking about the Near East, and he makes this brilliant observation. And this is one of the things that Joseph Campbell said that you've got to really know. He said, it's uniquely in the Levantine creation myth that we find the concept of master-slave relationship between humanity and God. And by Levantine, he means the Near East, the Levant. So that would include ancient Babylon and so forth. So, really important point here. Go and look at other mythologies. Go and look at other names from God other than the Sumerian name, which means master or slave master. And you won't find that those other names for God or the goddess mean anything like that. So what are we looking at? We're looking at a unique scenario that emerged in the Middle East, which I call the Anunnaki script. And as you know, the Anunnaki script is getting a lot of coverage on the internet and a lot of discussion. It's a vastly discussed subject. The subject of, associated with Sitchin, people like that. What is so important about this Anunnaki script? Well, it's important because it shows the archontic deviation, actually where the archontic deviation away from goddess religion began. And it began with a script that tells us, first of all, a big lie, that humanity was engineered by aliens from another planetary system. That's a lie. That's disinformation. Secondly, it tells us that the reason why humanity, the human genome, was engineered was so that we could be a slave species. This is a complete lie. And this script is the example of what the Gnostics were talking about when they warned us of the Archons, who are called the governors or controllers. The Anunnaki script is not the Sumerian cuneiform tablets, which are so widely discussed and, I must add, uncritically taken for true, have been actually referred to in certain Gnostic writings and critiqued. If you go and look at certain of the Nag Hammadi texts, they refer to episodes and features of this Anunnaki script. They don't refer to the names of Enki and Enlil, I'll get to them in a minute, but they refer, for instance, to the attempt of the Archons to genetically meddle with the human species. But they say that the attempt failed. Now, there's a new plot for you. Instead of buying Sitchin's very dubious translation, by the way, all the Sumerian tablets, and saying, oh, finally we know why was such a slavish, miserable species controlled by these authorities. Why, look here. It all goes back to the Anunnaki who created us and made us genetically, designed us to be slaves. Completely wrong. The human genome was engineered in the Galactic Center. We were endowed with properties of play, discovery, mutual aid, innocence. We are not made to be slaves. We are made to be inventors, artists, creators. Look at all indigenous people. They have nothing. They live with nature. They have nothing. And look at how they dress. Look at how they act. Look at the beauty of their dancing, the beauty of their culture, the beauty of the decorations of their bodies. That is the indigenous true nature of the human species. And they are not slaves to anyone, but they were all taken out of their natural environment and made into slaves by people who bought this Anunnaki agenda. And why do people enforce this Anunnaki agenda? Because it is the signature and legitimation of theocracy and social control. And that's all it ever was. It's not a genuine myth. It's probably a channeled myth that was constructed and designed intentionally.
To give the first tyrants and theocrats a basis of spiritual authority. Technically, a myth like this is called a foundation myth. The Anunnaki Sumerian scenario states a master-slave relationship between God or the gods, the Anunnaki, presumed to be an extraterrestrial race, and humanity. And this is exactly the foundation myth that the control freaks on the planet would like to use to assert their authority and the basis for their domination of the rest of the race.
Thank you. Wow. Lauren has another question.
Sure.
The theories in your book are, on the surface, rather incendiary to those who identify themselves as Christians. I recall the first interview I heard with you by Episcopalian minister Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. He seemed unable to accept any attempt you made to strike a balance between intense criticism of and yet compassion for Christians. Well, I would venture to say that most of us on the forum are not Christian. There are nevertheless many who are. Many of us non-theists, including myself, find this tightrope difficult to criticizing what we feel is a destructive ideology to the world and the individual psyche without ripping the rug out from under so many who seem to desperately need it for emotional well-being. Can you address this dichotomy?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Oh, my. Well, just let me say again, if I can put people at ease, which with Kali breathing down my neck is not always the easiest thing for me to do. But I don't have anything against Christians as people, and I grew up with Christians, and some of my most beloved friends that I left behind in the United States are wonderful people. What I have, I'm on the rampage, and I'm on the warpath to utterly destroy the belief system that Christians hold, the ideology of salvation and the Messiah. And so that's what I hate, and that's what I protest, the belief system and the behaviors that are based on that belief system, but not the people who demonstrate those behaviors. It's very difficult to walk that line. It is a tightrope, and it takes not only compassion, but sobriety and balance. Ian Punnett really had a difficult time with me because I think it was pretty clear that I had no animosity against Christians as people, but there is no middle ground here, you know. And those who are dependent upon that belief system for their sense of humanity and for their moral guidelines, unfortunately, you know, are so corrupted by that system that it may be impossible to reach them. What they are using to protect their humanity is actually destroying it. And I don't have the answer to what to do about that. But I will tell you this, I don't have compassion for people whose humanity has been destroyed. I only have compassion for people who are holding on to their true humanity.
Mm. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Uranus, you have a question for John?
Yes, John, in your book you write about the savior complex and the victim-perpetrator bond that forms in abusive relationships. Personally, I've seen it a little bit differently as a triad, especially alive and well in group dynamics. Victim, perpetrator, and of course the necessary savior to come and rescue the victim. Would you expand on the savior complex, how you see this working, how it arose, took root, and remains rooted in the psyche of humanity?
Well, sure. You know, your formula is clear and cogent one, I would say. You make it a three-point formula, the victim, perpetrator, and the savior. In my exposition of that formula, I show that the savior, the third element, is present. And the way that the complex mutates is that the savior can be either the victim or the perpetrator. In the toxic pathology of this Palestinian salvation system, the Messiah, who takes one form in Jesus Christ, is the savior, obviously, but is also the divine victim. In fact, he fulfills his mission by being the divine victim. So, savior is victim. But then you come to the book of Revelation, which is the final chapter in the script of this salvationism. And what do you see? Well, Jesus is there, enthroned in the clouds, as the judge of humanity, alongside the Father. So he is then the perpetrator, because he judges humanity and he enforces retribution, condemnation, and hellish punishment on the part of the human race that have not conformed to the Father's plan. So you see, it's the same formula. You want to break it down into three, or treat it just as victim-perpetrator. The origin of this formula is the Zadok cult of the ancient Hebrews, which I mentioned earlier, was a splinter cult that caused a lot of problem in the Jewish world, because most of the Jewish people were happy to adapt. They kept to their own ways, but they didn't enforce their ways on anyone else. And they allowed the pagans to have their gods and goddesses. Everyone got along just fine. But there was this radical sect. This is the sect of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are documents of vitriolic poison and hatred. Just, that's not my opinion. Go look at them. Go read them. They are documents of genocide and of murderous apocalyptic hatred. And that was, they were the documents of the Zadokim, or this radical sect, that was the seed of this salvationist virus. It emerged in Palestine, probably around 600 or 700 BC. It mutated and grew. And then with, what happened with, Saul, or St. Paul, was that it went pandemic. Rather than the virus, rather than being merely confined to a splinter group of Zionist fanatics in the Jewish community, was converted by Paul into a universal or Catholic belief system. And so so through the medium of St. Paul, we have what I call the transference. And this is how that vicious, toxic, genocidal and geocidal ideology exploded through Roman Catholicism and spread to the entire world, infected the entire world. And today we are living in the terminal phase of that that infection. Lanced, that's the word I was looking for. The abscess of that infection has to be lanced now. if humanity is going to survive.
Well, it's interesting because looking at it from a dichotomy as opposed to a triad, it actually makes it more devious and convoluted, in my opinion. And on to my next question. There is much speculation these days about an upcoming ascension of humanity, often with ET, UFO intervention, or salvation. Maybe it is a matter of linguistics, but I wonder if this sort of thinking is a distraction at best or an arcanic manipulation at worst. I tend to see this as another example of dissociation, a separating that is intended to break our relatedness and relationships with each other, animals, plants, and Gaia. Is the linguistics around ascension different from humanity's co-evolution with Gaia and our soulful desire to go deeper, return, remember our bodies, minds, relationship with Gaia? Would you comment on this?
It's pretty much as you say. It's a complex of dissociation, long in the making. It's an archontic manipulation. Ascension is a call to a dissociation from the source of life. You know, we are such fortunate creatures because among all the animals on the earth, we all depend on the earth itself as our source. But we, among all those animals, can turn to the source and can have a deep, deep and interactive relationship with the source. Ascension and all the claptrap and accessories and promises of ET salvation that go along with it takes us away from that. Our salvation, if you want to use that chained word, is not in ascension. It's in immersion. Immersion. When you experience the divine luminosity, the living luminosity of the planet, the organic light, when you experience that and you encounter Gaia directly, you are in a state of total immersion. You are immersed in your own cellular electrochemical instrument to the degree that you are in complete ecstasy. Gnosis is cognitive ecstasy. When you see the organic light, when you meet the goddess, when she breathes on you, you are immersed in ecstasy. This ecstasy is our salvation. In this ecstasy is everything we want, everything we long for. It's the final remembering. It's love. It's pleasure. It's discovery. It's wisdom. It's delight. It's everything that is beautiful and true about being a human being. And anything that takes us away from that with a promise of a non-human or extra-human solution is a lie.
Thank you for that. That's obviously from your heart, and I appreciate it, John.
Thank you for your question. Also
thanks,
from your heart.
Yes.
Thank you, John. We're on the home stretch. We're going into
sure.
the rights. We're going to the rights actions section. You're in a second question.
All right. Action. Okay. All right.
Are you ready for this? Okay. Cliff High's latest article on halfpasthuman.com, he wrote, "You are dead. They murdered you. And you need to get beyond the anger that this knowledge brings. There is yet work you must do." Then he went on to write, "You are murdered. This is your power." These words immediately brought to my mind an initiation process of the Dogara people of Africa and other various indigenous cultures, which necessarily include facing death both existentially and physically. Since the transpersonal Pluto moved into Capricorn in 2008, I have felt that we are approaching a time of mass initiation, a rite of passage, if you may, and this would bring about a process for humanity as a whole. Since then, we began to see the breakdown of structures and systems, be those financial, cultural, national, religious. along with these destructions, personal beliefs and identities have been challenged, if not crushed. I sense this process is leading on to dismemberment of ego structures. People's sense of who they are and what they thought the world was is collapsing. Then throw in earth changes, solar activity, destruction, and potential mass death. Is humanity approaching the potential for moving to an impersonal, selfless, freeing, mythic life and able to allow the divine to live through us? What are your thoughts on this, John?
Wow. Well, I like to emphasize that a telestes, a teacher, shaman, guide from the mystery school could be a man or a woman, because it was a totally egalitarian system. That a telestes is called that because it means I am one who is aimed. And to be aimed is a beautiful, beautiful feeling. To be aimed. And the question is, what can we be aimed by? So I think I would not exactly say that there's a mass initiation process going on, because I'm not sure. This is the first time that humanity has ever been at the threshold where it is right now. In fact, last month on the 19th, a momentous event happened regarding Gaia's reconnection to the Pleuromic Center, the galactic core. So we're in an unprecedented moment of change and breakdown. So I'm not going to predict, certainly I never predict, and I want to leave the range, this opportunity wide open. But I will say that direction is important. We are a species that needs to go in a certain direction. We just can't go into independence without having a goal. And if Telestes is guided by the story of Sophia, so I strongly encourage people to learn this story and to realize that we are now in the 9th episode when she makes her correction and we take our role in that correction. Or not. You know, to go back to the analogy of the mothership, I like this, and I think I'm going to use it more in the future. Not everyone on the mothership is communicating with the pilot. It's not necessary. So there's the pilot, which is Gaia. She's sending out the coordinates for the course of the journey. She knows now. She's locked onto a signal on March 19th, locked onto a signal, homing signal to the Pleuromic Center. And in effect, transmitted to the Pleuromic Center, yes, during the supermoon, right after the Japan earthquake, the 19th, transmitted to the Pleuromic Center her set of coordinates to correct the course of the mothership, to correct humanity's evolution. And so some people on Earth will join her crew. Some of them will be the crew of the mothership, taking care of it, repairing the ecology of the planet, getting back to a sane and clean way to live in the environment. Some, like the shamans and visionaries, will be in the navigational crew, navigating with Gaia. And that's a fascinating process and a fascinating responsibility. But there will just be some who are passengers. And there will be some rats who will desert the ship, and people who will jump overboard because they're out of their minds. So I wouldn't exactly call that a collective initiation process. I'd call it a sorting out process. And the one thing that I'd like to add is vast subjects we're talking here about, but the one thing I'd like to add to plant as a seed in your minds, to think about after this interview, is that the idea of impersonal service is not in Gaia's syntax. Service is not in Gaia's syntax. She doesn't want us to serve her. she doesn't understand what service is. Service belongs to the master-slave paradigm. She wants us to play with her. She wants us to co-evolve. And she wants us to do it through the highest pleasure and highest desire of our individual selves. That is to say, there is no sacrifice, there is no loss of yourself in this co-evolutionary bond to her. On the contrary, you are invited and inspired to develop your potential to the highest possible degree and to love yourself and love your own genius as it manifests in the frame of her symbiosis. So this is what we're looking for. This is the process that we might envision facing us right now.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have written that you are contra violence, and Cliff High has said that violence is a trap of the powers that be. He advocates shunning and other asymmetrical responses. You are advocating superior warriorship, impersonal Gaia ethical actions against humanity's perpetrators. On metahistory.org, you wrote, "Contraviolence is the use of violence by people opposed to violence who, nevertheless, regard a nonviolent response as inadequate in certain situations. The term contraviolence signifies action taken against violence, equivalent to it in strength and effectiveness, not passive nonviolent resistance. But the action so taken does not involve direct contact, physical enactment of violence. Rather, it involves activating aggressive, lethal force equivalent and superior to the violence opposed. John, with all that is confronting us at this time by the Archon mindset and their minions, the powers that be, now seems a very good time to hear your thoughts on this."
Yeah, I guess it would be the moment. Thank you for reading those words. I don't know how clearly I expressed myself there. As you may have noted, if you follow what I put on MetaHistory site, I'm taking really great care, great care with my language and self-scrutiny to set out this contra-violence proposition. So what can I tell you right here and now? Well, first of all, I don't agree that violence is a trap of the powers that be. It's a tool. It's not a trap. You can get trapped in it because it has a captivating quality. And violence, if you're not centered as a warrior, and if you're not centered in your own, in self-love, don't mean love, by the way, self-love, if you're not centered in self-love, you're not going to be able to handle violence because it has a way of consuming people and infecting people. But violence in itself is not to be categorically rejected. You know, what I'm proposing in contra-violence is that that violent force, especially the violent force of transpersonal rage, be directed against the perpetrators. Transpersonal rage, and we all have it in us, and it's mounting as I speak. I've been extremely cautious in presenting this right action message, but I feel confident that I am speaking to the rage that arises in the hearts of many, many people. Murderous rage. And I want to tell anyone who's listening to this that if you feel murderous rage, if you would feel murderous rage toward a man who abducted, raped, and killed your 12-year-old daughter or son, you would just be reacting like a true human being. If you didn't feel murderous rage toward that perpetrator, there would be something not lacking in your humanity. And just as you could feel murderous rage in that horrific instance, and there are many others that happen, events that happen every day that are just as horrific as that, just as you would feel that rage in a personal instance, you can feel that rage transpersonally. You know? To give you an example of when I feel this rage all the time. I live with it. But Kali is the rage of Gaia. And I live in her rage. It's a storm I live in. I heard a couple of years ago that the banksters, the Goldman Sachs people, financial mafia who are taking down countries with their fraudulent schemes, had, you know, that was just when they'd gone in and taken down Greece. They set up Greece by manipulating it to violate the credit guidelines of the European Union. And when it had done so, they went in and brought it down. You know, this is how they operate. They create a financial problem. And I heard that these people were going to blackmailing the country of Greece to pay them off by giving them islands. That caused me to feel murderous rage. And that's just one of a long instance of examples. I'm not going to go into it. So I think that I'm certain that I am speaking here to a rage that exists in the hearts and minds of many people. And I want to tell you that you can be a good and decent and loving human being and still have this rage in you. But I want to tell you something that's a little more challenging than that as well. You've got to do something with it. It cannot just be left to boil in you. It needs to be expressed. And so I'm laying out the framework of right action and contraviolence as a path to express the transpersonal rage. And I make no bones about it. This rage can be used as a weapon and a tool, and it can be directed as a lethal force against perpetrators. I'm talking about lethal kill. But I'm not talking about a kill of physical presence. It would be a lethal kill that is effected in a magical way. It is not effected through a knife or a gun or a bomb or poison or hiring someone to take someone out. It is actually shamanic magic. And I would point out to you finally, before we get into the remaining questions about this, we've all seen a massive revival of shamanism since the 60s. And we have an enormous amount of shamanism and an enormous revival of shamanic practices, including ayahuasca ceremonies and things like that. But there's one thing that's being overlooked in all of this shamanic revival, and that is that in every indigenous culture, from the Urals to the Amazon to Polynesia, the shaman in the community could heal and also kill. And you are not qualified as a shaman, a true shaman, unless you could do both. So what I want to put on the table is a discussion of the killing powers of shamanism.
That sounds great.
Thank you, Uranus. Thank you, John. Patrick, you have a question for John.
Yes, John. I think we're going into space goat farts territory here.
Sure.
On page 77 of your book, you had a quotation. The war scroll reads like a weirdly ceremonious boot camp drill intended to prepare the troops for that final hallucinatory event. Can you elaborate on the event and what it alluded to? And what is the non-human extraterrestrial ET connection?
Sure. It's my contention from the study of the Dead Sea Scrolls that the Tzadikim sect at the Dead Sea and also other areas around the area like Damascus, probably a sect that consisted of maybe 4,000 to 6,000 people, very small, radical sect of ultra-conservative, perfectionist xenophobes. The zealots of the Dead Sea Caves were part of a UFO cult. I believe that they were a UFO cult. I believe that they had seen UFOs, or thought they had seen UFOs, which would have been archontic hallucinations at that time. And that these UFOs are actually described in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I cite the passages in my book. You can read it. If it, you know, people often cite the vision of Ezekiel as
as in UFO sighting, don't they? Well, she should read what the Dead Sea Scrolls say about the Kenoshim, I can't remember which it is. These are shining wheels in the sky. I mean, the description of them is identical to UFO flying hardware. So they were a UFO cult, and the scene described in the War Scroll is a final battle when the righteous ones, who are the ones who follow the rule of Jehovah, the off-planet god, rise up against the rest of humanity, who are all partying and getting along just fine and ignoring the Father God, and go into battle to annihilate us. This is the apocalyptic ending described in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And there's a drill. They're practicing the drill for this to happen. They're lining up their armies. And they fully believe that the flying saucer gods are going to come and help them in this apocalyptic showdown at the end of time, which probably we're due to live out sometime in the next 18 months, thanks to the virtues of Operation Blue Beam and virtual reality technologies, you know. So we're actually living out this. Go read read the Dead Sea Scrolls. You owe it to yourself. Read the War Scroll. You can find it on the internet. And you'll see how insane it is. But this psychosis and the idea that the ET saviors are going to come is clear as day in that text.
Thank you, John.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John. And I guess you must be really excited about the recent discovery of the 70 new codices that they found in East Jordan over 5 years ago. So that'd be really interesting to see what information comes out of that. You couldn't care less.
No, it's like we're all on a bus and the bus keeps going around and around and it ran over a chicken. And we all got out of the bus and we picked meat off the chicken to make a chicken salad. And then the bus went around again and it ran over the chicken again. And every time it runs over the carcass of the chicken, we climb out of the bus to pick out more meat off the bones. And that's the carcass of Jesus, you know. There's no more meat on those bones. We're not going to make a chicken salad out of Jesus again, no matter what's in these bloody scrolls. It really doesn't matter. The story was sick in the beginning, it was sick in the middle, and it's sick in the end. And I think it's a big distraction to even care about some kind of new revelation coming out of ancient scrolls. They're not Gnostic documents, I don't believe, and so I don't expect much from them.
Yeah. I guess if they were contradictory to the official story, then they wouldn't be mentioning it. Yeah,
and what difference does it make? You know, you saw what happened with the Da Vinci Code. That was like a shock. And so where are we now? Now, the thrill is gone, and has that really changed anything in the insanity of the belief systems that are driving our behavior? Nothing. You know, keep away from it. But on the whole, it's not going to be a great revelation, and I don't think it's going to be either.
Yep. The next question we have is from Uranus Rising.
John, in Gnostic cosmology, the first episode of the Sophia Mythos says a singularity arises within the Godhead, the realm of the Pleroma, divine fullness, which is astronomically the galactic center. The singularity carries the potential for novelty to emerge in the universe. It is called Anthropos. I'm curious to see what you envisage or imagine will be revealed or experienced when Gaia aligns with the galactic center on the 21st of December 2012.
Well, first of all, can I say something about 2012?
Sure, please do.
There is no alignment with the galactic center at 2012. Sorry to be poop on the parade. But it's just a meme that's going around. It's a rumor that's going around. And it is astronomically false. There is an alignment of the winter solstice, which is a point on the ecliptic plane of the Earth. An alignment of the winter solstice, where the sun stands on December 21st, to the galactic center. Now, every year, December 21st, the sun occupies that point.
But that point, the winter solstice, does not coincide with the galactic center right now. It's about 3 degrees to the east of it. The best estimate for the sight line to the galactic center is 27 degrees of Sagittarius. Okay? And the winter solstice, of course, is 30 degrees of Sagittarius. So there's 3 degrees of separation. That means that the winter solstice has to drift by precession 3 more degrees, and then we have complete and perfect lock-in phase between the ecliptic plane of our solar system and the line to the galactic center. That happens in about 200 years, because 3 degrees of precession is about 210 years. So, not only is there not a, there is a unique astronomical alignment in 200 years, not in 2012, and not only is that the case, but the Mayan calendar was recently recalculated, and the correlation that has been used since the 1930s was overthrown. You may have heard this. And according to the new correlation, Mayan calendar ends in about 200 years. So this is what we're looking at.
Is the end of the Kali Yuga at the same time?
Yes, it is. Kali Yuga ends in 2216 AD.
Where do I get that figure? I base it on 5 things. Correlation of the Hindu, Egyptian, Maya, and Aztec calendar systems. That's 4 calendar systems, coordinated with the star calendar of precession, which is not a human-made calendar system. It's actually the phenomenon of precession. You can't argue with what I'm saying. The winter solstice coincides with the galactic center around 2216. That is also the end of Kali Yuga. It's the end of the great precessional cycle as a whole, and it is the beginning of the next great precessional cycle. That is, 2216 is the 0 hour of the great precessional cycle. Now, in my opinion, the fact of putting that ahead 200 years in time is a very hopeful thing, because it means that now we are engaged in Gaia's correction, right now, since March 19th, and that we have that time to become adept to coevolution, and to become skilled in navigating with her, to understand how she navigates. You want to learn how Gaia Sophia navigates the planet through the galaxy? This is learnable. I'm teaching this right now. It has to do with the apsides of the moon, the perigee and apogee of the moon. That's the steering device that she uses. Mm. So it's absolutely, and I think that Cliff High, you know, funny thing, I just want to bring in Cliff for a minute. Brilliant mind. And I was listening to an interview that he did for 2 hours with someone, and he was talking about things, and I thought, my God, I wonder if he uses any astronomy or lunar astronomy or studies the lunar cycles, or I wonder if he knows about the apsides of the moon, which is the perigee and apogee points, because some of the things he says were very closely parallel to my own findings based on that phenomenon. You know, the whole secret of Gaia's correction in astronomical terms is the apsides of the moon and the barycenter of the moon. That's the whole secret. And it has cyclic properties. You can study when the steering is being done. You can study when the steering mechanism is being moved and shifted one way or another by studying the barycenter and the cycles of the moon. And as I was listening to him, I thought, well, I understand that he gets his predictions and his ideas from dredging the internet, but some of them were so close to my own observations that I wondered if he might be onto that same trick.
I do know that he does follow the lunar calendar.
Okay.
Any more than that, I can't say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he does use a lot of other material, resource analysis of materials, and astrology perhaps. I think Bob Heath or something, astrologer that he gets information from. But yeah, he does follow other methods along with the internet information.
Sure, sure. Well, my main source of information, you know, I have a saying here, or I'll put it in form of a riddle. What is the best source of information about what's happening on the planet?
Is that a question? Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, what's the best source of information about what's happening on the planet?
Your inner instinct, I guess.
No.
Gaia.
The planet. Yeah. The best source of information about what's happening on the planet is the planet. So, how do you get information from the planet itself directly? This is what the Gnostic seers did. They called it mathesis. They also called it theoria. You know, the word theory now means a kind of hypothetical structure or some kind of hypothesis or some intellectual construction. But originally in the mysteries, theoria meant beholding. That is the original meaning of the word theoria, to behold. And what did they behold? Well, they beheld the organic light. They went into heightened states of trance. And they got information directly from the planet. And we can do the same. And this is the great breakthrough right now. This is the moment that this is coming. This is happening. And she is making this massively available to those who pick up on it. That doesn't mean that the masses will pick up on it. But I assure you that she is making it massively available.
Thank you, John. John, as we end this discussion, we wanted to ask one final question. This question is from Lolly.
This question is actually from my friend Bluebird on the forum. Please share your vision for the near future to integrate meaningful myths into our daily lives.
Well, myth is a big subject, and I would propose to you that each of us...
You can get lost in myth. Jung did. He was often overwhelmed by the material he was exploring and discovering it. And in fact, when he broke up with his first mistress, Sabina Spielrein, who had guided him through the mythological process, he actually had a mental breakdown and had to retreat for a number of years. At moments in my life, I was also overwhelmed by the material, somewhat in the same manner.
I warn you, my friends, you don't have time for that now. So I would like to give you this advice. There's only two myths that you need to know in order to get on track with your life and into the symbiosis and the wonder of Gaia's solution. The first myth is the one that every human being should know, the myth that was withheld from us, the myth that the predators tried to destroy, the Sophianic vision and story, the myth of the fallen goddess. This is the myth to guide the species. This is the myth that every human being should know. So learn that myth. You can read about it on my website or in my book, or listen to the narration of it, which is on the internet from Grok the Talk, Thomas Malone. Secondly, if you're fascinated and attracted by the beauty of myth, just remember one thing. The time for armchair mythology is over. Campbell is dead. Eliade is dead. And it's their successor, John Lash, talking now. And he says, he advises, that directive and applied myth is the only kind. Live it. It's not to play games. It's not to interpret. It's not to make excuses. It's to live it. And so live the myth of Sophia. And then there is one other myth you need to know about. And that is your destiny vector into her story. Each of us has a destiny vector into her story. Each of us has a life thread, a personal mythology that weaves like a tendril into the vast tapestry of her life. And that myth of your destiny vector is shown by two things. Is shown by the position of the sun and the earth in the constellations at the moment that you were born. Not in the astrological signs, in the constellations. You can identify your myth by the constellation and from there develop and explore that myth. And that is the myth that you will live into as you merge into her story. And that's only two myths that you need to know, yours and hers.
Just lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John. I hope it's been enjoyable for you, as it has been for us. If not, bad luck, sir. George Gurdjieff said, "To know all, it is necessary to know very little. But to know that very little, one must first know pretty much. In an age of soundbites, you have broken away from this broadest view, searching for the truth of our history. Your information is aimed at empowering us all, and that is the difference that makes you as close to a true Nocene and a Telestis. On behalf of Fox and all the members of the WebBot Forum, we thank you, John. In the tradition of the WebBot Forum, may you have many pies to come."
And the same to you, my friends. It's been a great pleasure and privilege. Bye for now.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Sure, thank you.